national importance rests with the Chief Constable.
The bungling Chief Constable of West Midlands Police inexplicably is still in his job, despite having lost the support of just about everyone, and the hopeless PCC over there keeps him in his job. Why? And
how important it is from our side to strengthen our cooperation with the United States, but that doesn't mean that we want to be owned by the United States.
That's the Greenland Foreign Minister after a frank meeting at the White House. They say the island is not for sale and that fundamental disagreements remain. We'll bring you the latest.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, there are growing calls for the head of West Midlands Police to be sacked over a decision to ban Israeli football fans from a match in Birmingham. Craig Guildford insists the decision to stop Maccabi Tel Aviv fans from attending a game at Aston Villa wasn't politically motivated. But the reports found the risk posed by supporters had been overstated by the force. Shadow Home Secretary Chris Philp has told LBC that the Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood must force him to go.
The Home Secretary no longer has the power to directly sack the Chief Constable, but under Section 40, she does have the power to make the Police and Crime Commissioner do it for her. And there was unanimity across the House of Commons, both sides, that Craig Guildford must go. Even the Labour leader of Birmingham City Council has said that. So I really think his position is completely untenable.
Well, the West Midlands Police and Crime Commissioner has declined to sack Craig Guildford, saying he's waiting for a parliamentary report over what happened. The US president says he's been told that killings in Iran's crackdown on nationwide protests are stopping. Donald Trump says he believes there's currently no plan for large-scale executions. Iran has threatened to target American sites in neighbouring countries if the US leader intervenes in anti-regime protests. Here, the government says a British embassy in Tehran has temporarily been closed and will now operate remotely. Well, meanwhile, Donald Trump says America needs Greenland for national security.
If we don't go in, Russia's going to go in and China's going to go in. There's not a thing that Denmark can do about it.
The island's Danish-controlled, but the US president's threatened to take over. Denmark's foreign minister says after meetings in the White House, Denmark and the US have agreed to disagree. Former London's Burnings actor John Alford has been jailed for 8.5 years. It's the 54-year-old who was found guilty of sexually assaulting two teenage girls at a party 4 years ago. And the mayor of Greater Manchester has told LBC he expects investment to start flowing into the city. The Treasury's announced plans for a new railway line between Manchester and Birmingham, though hasn't said when it will be ready. Labour's Andy Burnham says it's a good day nevertheless.
The investment is already flowing into the city, but it'll just come through more and more because investors will be able to see where we're going in the next couple of decades and think, right, this is the place to be.
In the city, the FTSE 100's closed up 47 points at 10,184. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.15. LBC weather, heavy rain and strong winds moving into southern England and Wales tomorrow. A mixture of cloud and isolated showers in western Scotland. A high of 10 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Daryl Jackson.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Henry Reilly.
3 minutes past 10 is the time. Good evening. You're listening to Henry Reilly here on LBC. This hour,
what the Iranian regime is doing to its own people is absolutely appalling and reprehensible. This is the murder of unarmed demonstrators, thousands of them we gather.
Ed Miliband speaking with Andrew Marr, joining the chorus of critics for the Iranian regime. We'll bring you the latest next with the former UK Defence Secretary Jeff Hoon and Donald Trump's former National Security Advisor John Bolton joins us. Staying with global matters, ministers from Greenland, Denmark meet senior officials in Washington, D.C. This was Donald Trump's reaction.
We need Greenland for national security, so we're going to see what happens. If we don't go in, Russia's going to go in and China's going to go in, and there's not a thing that Denmark can do about it.
The Chief Constable of West Midlands Police is still in his job. He was asked by Nick Ferrari in August, what makes a good copper?
Decent moral compass, the ability to make the right judgment, not to be judgmental, We're not judge and jury. We gather the evidence.
I think he should set his standards by that with which he set other officers and probably go, given the Home Secretary's demanding his resignation after midnight.
All road users need to sit within the law, and that's all ridiculous to think that because you want to have the laws apply to road users that somehow you're anti anything at all. You're not. You're actually pro-safety.
New traffic lights and pedestrian crossings introduced to curb excessive speed when it comes to cyclists. Is it fair, or are they just being singled out? And later in the show... Redmond, the man behind Brookside, Hollyoaks and Grange Hill. He'll be speaking with you, speaking to me, about how to nominate your town of culture.
Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. This is LBC.
Good evening to you. We have heard today the US and the UK reducing the number of personnel at one of their air bases in Qatar, a very significant air base, as Donald Trump still ponders whether to take action against Iran over its crackdown of anti-government protesters. CBS have said that the partial American withdrawal was a precautionary measure. This, as the British Foreign Office confirms, that it's also temporarily closed the British Embassy in Tehran. This was Donald Trump speaking in the last couple of hours from the Oval Office.
We've been told that the killing in Iran is stopping, and it's stopped, and it's stopping. And there's no plan for executions or executions. So I've been told that a good authority will find out about it. I'm sure if it happens, we'll all be very upset, including you will be very upset. But that's just gotten to me, some information that the killing has stopped, that the executions have stopped. They're not going to have an execution, which a lot of people were talking about for the last couple of days. Today was going to be the day of execution.
We've also heard in the last half an hour or so from the Iranian foreign minister. The full broadcast interview hasn't come out yet, but Abbas Araghchi has spoken with Fox News.
But it was the U.S. who always escaped from diplomacy, who cut the diplomacy and opted for war. My message is, between war and diplomacy, diplomacy is a better way, although we don't have any positive experience from the United States, but still, diplomacy is much better than war.
What of the British government? This was the Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, speaking earlier with my colleague, Andrew Marr.
What the Iranian regime is doing to its own people is absolutely appalling and reprehensible.
Mm.
This is the murder of unarmed demonstrators, thousands of them we gather.
Mm-hmm.
Yvette Cooper said on Monday that we're going to take all necessary measures of sanctions against the regime. I think nobody should be in any doubt about the appalling nature of this regime, because we can see before our own eyes what they're doing to their own people.
Let's bring into the conversation Ambassador John Bolton, the former U.S. National Security Advisor in the first Trump administration. He was also a former U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. In a moment, I'll also be speaking with the former U.K. Defense Secretary, Jeff Hoon. But first to Ambassador Bolton, your thoughts on what we've heard in the last few hours. Has there been a change in tact, do you sense, from the president? Good evening.
Good evening. Well, you know, he makes up his mind four or five times before he makes up his mind. We used to say no decision with Trump is final until it's final, and then even then it's not final. So I think he's giving himself leeway. I think he's prepared for either eventuality. I think that's what the evacuation of U.S. and U.K. diplomatic personnel from various posts around the region indicates. And my guess is he'll wake up tomorrow morning and decide what to do.
So you don't think it's imminent tonight? It's interesting. We had "help is on the way" that really dominated the news, those few words yesterday. Today he seems to be talking about the killing stopping and talking about the individual sentence to the death penalty stopping. So you don't sense that is a change in heart? That's a temporary change, if anything.
Well, I think it's really hard to say. I mean, it could be tonight. You'll find out about it before most Americans, because you'll get up earlier than we do. But I think it is important. Trump did draw red lines, and if he doesn't do anything about it, I think his credibility will be hurt. I think what you heard him doing was trying to erase the red lines, but in fact they're out there. And the regime, indeed, not just because of these 3 weeks of demonstrations, but for many, many fundamental reasons, and in this case mostly the economy, just in terrible shape. I think the regime is very weak. I think it's vulnerable. And I'd hate to see the opportunity missed to take significant action that might well facilitate regime change.
What would you be telling the U.S. president now if you were the National Security Advisor?
That he should look at a strategy that leads to regime change before you decide what you're going to do. You have to decide what your objective is. That's not the way Trump proceeds, but that's the way you should proceed. And I think to help achieve regime change, we want to encourage the opposition. We want to affect people within the military in Iran, even the Revolutionary Guard, that the days of the regime may be numbered, and therefore they want to consider defecting to the opposition, bringing their troops with them. And we want to diminish the regime's power in the short term to repress its own people. So I would suggest attacking headquarters and other military facilities of the Revolutionary Guard and the Desiji militia, the paramilitary that really do a lot of the work against civilians in cities. I would look at attacking the nuclear program again, the ballistic missile program. Obviously, we would first take out any existing or new air defenses that have been put in since the 12-day war by Israel and the U.S., and that's where I'd start, at least.
Donald Trump said that if they continued killing people, that he would step in. That was about a week ago, and we still saw persistently the Iranian regime, the IRGC, killing civilians in Iran. If now there is some sort of compromise that has been reached, I mean, I'm already getting messages in, Ambassador Bolton, from people saying they don't want Donald Trump to let them down and that they don't want the Ayatollah to somehow survive this. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with that, but I think it's possible that's what he'll do. He will find some excuse to say, well, they didn't really cross the red line. But I think he's put himself out there, and now he's worried he doesn't know how to get back.
He sort of boxed himself in, or he led people up to the top of the hill and is going to have to march them down again.
Well, it's very similar to what he's done in Venezuela. There's not regime change there either. It's true we've captured Maduro, but the regime in Caracas is the Maduro regime without him, and they're not looking to negotiate their exit. They're trying to retain the power that they have, and this is typical Trump. He has a kind of one and done approach, do one dramatic thing. Even in bombing Iran last year, it was only three sites. The U.S. role only lasted for a few days. It did significant damage to Iran's nuclear program, but did not eliminate it.
Can I also ask you on a separate matter? We saw the foreign ministers of Denmark and Greenland in the White House today. We know that they've said there were frank but constructive discussions. Your view on where that turns next, the future of that island, Greenland?
Well, I must say the remarks by the Danish foreign minister after the talks were over were encouraging. He said basically neither side gave any ground on their basic position, and that nothing surprising there. But that they did agree to establish a working group to continue the discussions at a lower level. I think that's important. There is an answer to this question of how to provide not just for Greenland's security to protect the U.S., but to provide for the security of the entire NATO alliance, the U.S., Greenland, Denmark, Canada, everybody in NATO, from the growing threat of Chinese and Russian activity in the Arctic Ocean as the polar ice cap melts. We don't need sovereignty over Greenland. Trump may think he needs it psychologically. I'd be happy if the Greenlanders in a free and fair referendum voted to become an American Commonwealth. Trump has made that all but impossible. So let's do what we can do under the existing Defense of Greenland Treaty between the U.S. and Denmark. We may need modifications to deal with questions of mineral rights. I think that can be negotiated. But let's negotiate it and let's stop this damaging talk about U.S. military force being used against Greenland.
Thank you for your time. Ambassador John Bolton, the former U.S. National Security Advisor in the first Trump administration. He was also U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Jeff Hoon is former Labour Defence Secretary. He also served as Chief Whip and joins me. Thank you very much for joining us, Mr. Hoon. If I could ask you really the same question with which I started with Ambassador Bolton. Do you sense this is a change of heart from Donald Trump or merely a sort of temporary measure?
I'm not sure I can improve on John Bolton's knowledge of the workings of Donald Trump's mind, and I'm not even going to try. I thought he set out very clearly the issues as far as the president is concerned, and I think we have to wait and see.
Where do you think this goes next for the regime in Tehran?
Sadly, I think we've seen this before. We've seen demonstrations of this kind. We've seen the brutality of the regime, perhaps on a scale this time greater than ever before. But I never felt that this was likely to lead to an overthrow of Khomeini or the Revolutionary Guard, because they have a mutual interest in their respective survival. The mullahs who really run Iran do so in a very harsh way. The Revolutionary Guard are totally dependent upon them, and equally the mullahs are dependent on the Revolutionary Guard. And unless there was any crack in that alliance, and I don't see it, I can't see real change.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because you're right, we've had the sort of Green Revolution in 2009, we had Mahsa Amini, who was killed in 2022, sparked huge riots and demonstrations, I should say. And this time, it seemed, because of the rhetoric from President Trump, we might see some form of change or some form of action. It sounds like, from what you're saying, Mr. Hoon, that we may end up in a position where the Ayatollah stays in post and the mullahs likewise.
Well, I regret that. I agree with what Ed Miliband was saying about this regime. It is truly appalling, barbaric, medieval in its approach to human life. When the Revolutionary Guard and the militias are prepared to use their weapons on innocent, often young demonstrators, it's simply a demonstration that they care nothing for their own people. And whilst they're prepared to do that, I can't see any real prospect of change.
What of the UK government in all of this? I mean, it's a tricky position for Sir Keir Starmer, because, of course, of the allyship of the US, and clearly that medieval regime which Keir Starmer will hold no truck for. There was a criticism that he was quiet in the first few days, he and the Foreign Secretary. Your view on that?
I don't believe that's the case. I think, realistically, there's not a huge amount more that the United Kingdom can do. We cannot use force for legal reasons. There are a whole variety, perhaps, of non-military options available, and I hope that the government will be reviewing those and using as many as they can. But the reality is, it's only the United States that can take effective military action if the president chooses to do so.
How significant is it, in your role as a former Defence Secretary, that the Foreign Office have closed the embassy in Tehran?
I suspect that's a precautionary measure and a sensible one. And obviously, there are similar instructions to American citizens in Iran. I think John Bolton put the situation very well, that unless and until the president decides, we won't know what the outcome is. But obviously, in case he decides on military action, people are being forewarned and told to prepare.
And lastly, can I get a word from you on Greenland too?
I'm not going to second-guess John Bolton. He has far more experience of Washington than I will ever have. What I do know, though, is that there is clearly an ability for the United States to augment its existing fairly extensive military facility in Greenland. There's absolutely no reason why they could not reach an agreement with Denmark and the Greenlanders to significantly increase their military presence there. As I say, they have quite a significant base. That could be much, much larger. It'd actually probably be very good for Greenland, in the sense that it would create employment in a country that doesn't have a lot of obvious opportunities for work. So I can see a compromise short of sovereignty that would nevertheless protect Greenland and protect Western interest in making sure that neither Russia nor China gets a foothold there. And it seems to me that that's a deal that could be done.
Thank you for your time. Jeff Hoon is former Labour Defence Secretary. He served from 1999 to 2005 and also served as Chief Whip in the last Labour government too. Over to you now. It would appear that the rhetoric seems to have dialed down slightly, although, as we heard from John Bolton, don't take that for granted. That is President Trump speaking at the moment. He may well have something else planned. It would seem to me that it's not enough for President Trump to threaten all of this strong action, to talk about being here to help, and the Iranian government now saying that they will stop executing protesters, we don't know because they don't allow journalists in Iran, and to not execute people such as Irfan Soltani, who was the 26-year-old who was due to be killed today. It appears from various reports that that hasn't been the case. That's not enough. This situation is deplorable if we allow that poisonous regime led by the mullahs to stay in Iran. So it's all very well talking the talk, but I wonder if you think Donald Trump needs to walk the walk. 0345 60 60 973.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
They have fatal incompetence.
Straight to the point.
What is the problem they've got over there?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
The country's going backwards. Growth down. Energy prices up.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
There's one green bottle sat on my fridge shelf. This green and white bottle that supports my gut health. Beautiful by nature and biotiful by name. It's the tastiest way to up my gut health game.
Biotiful Gut Health. Upgrade your yogurt to the UK's number one kefir and reset your gut health with Biotiful. Kefir is a source of calcium which contributes to the normal function of digestive enzymes. For verification of UK's number one kefir, see biotifulguthealth.com/radio.
Hi Derek, Tara from Flash Designs here, hope you're well. Not sure if you've seen my emails from last month, but could you please pay my invoice? Thank you so much. Bye. Hi, it's Tara, Flash Designs. Did you get my last voicemail? I know you're busy, but please pay my invoice today, if possible. Hello, again. It's Tara, again. Politely nudging, again.
Still chasing unpaid invoices? Let Sage Copilot help do the chasing so you can get paid up to 7 days faster. Search Sage Accountant today.
The following is from TFL.
I got loads of flowers the other day. And messages from people I didn't even know. My mate spelled my name in tea lads. And my mum hung my favourite footy shirt on the railings. Next to the lamppost, where I got killed. By a nice lady. Just someone who thought it was okay to go a few miles an hour over the limit.
Speeding injures or kills over 1,000 people in London every year. Slow down. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
Henry Reilly on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
10:21 is the time. Good evening. You're listening to Henry Reilly here on LBC. Let's get straight to your calls. We're talking about this latest rhetoric from Iran. The foreign minister has been speaking with Fox News saying everything's under control. Well, not quite sure that's the case, but appealing for calm and appealing for diplomacy. That's as President Trump has really ramped up the rhetoric in recent days. And Donald Trump now saying that they've stopped killing, which, fine, but you look at the number of people they've killed so far in Iran, the death toll has reached more than 2,500, according to a US rights-based group. Is it really good enough to give him a bit of a slap on the wrist and say, that's it, we're not going to intervene? What should we do now? What happens next with the Iranian regime? Because clearly it's not good enough to say that they've now stopped killing people. I mean, this is an intolerable situation. What happens next? 0345 6060973. Let's go first to Oregon, and Andrew's in Springfield. Hi, Andrew, what do you want to say?
Hi there. Well, a few things. One, be wary when you advocate for regime change in other countries. We all did that in Syria. It didn't work out very well.
Mm-hmm.
Two, Donald Trump was the one that reimposed sanctions. There was a deal that allowed some goods to get through to Iran because of the nuclear deal that they had. He's the one that shut that one down, put them back onto full sanction modes. And the reason I phoned in really was, can you imagine if there were thousands of people setting fires in the streets of the USA complaining about ICE? He lauded the murder of Rene Good protesting. He lauded it. He said, this is great. His stormtroopers over here seem to think, now, they haven't been pushed to the point, but if they were pushed to the same point, I think you would be having the same discussions about the USA.
Okay. Well, I mean, look, that...
And I'm not belittling the harm and horror of the Iranian regime.
Fine, but let's just put it in perspective. Clearly there is a lot of criticism, and rightly so, by the way, and I've seen the videos, and, I mean, to put it mildly, I'm not on the same page as Donald Trump, right? It's pretty clear that Rene Good was killed, and I disagree with the way that ICE agents are virtually untouchable. However, Andrew, you can put that to one side, and ultimately, Donald Trump is in a democracy, and ultimately he is constrained. I know you may argue he doesn't always adhere to that, but he's meant to be constrained by various peers of government. I mean, literally in Iran, they are killing people for going out onto the streets and protesting. You wouldn't have that in the US if people were protesting against Rene Good, I don't feel. Of course, you live there, so I don't know. But you can't just equate one with the other, I don't think.
Well, I think a few years ago, people would say, well, Trump's not a... He's not a fascist. He's not far right. They used to debate this. I'd phone in. I'd say, I think he's a fascist. And they say, well, can you use some other language? Now, he's getting there. He hasn't got there yet. He's planning to send American troops. I've got my niece's boyfriend could possibly get sent to Greenland. I asked him, are you going to go to war in Greenland? And he was like, that's just talk. He would never do it. These people don't expect that they may be shot at. There's the very real possibility that someone, you can't make a deal by force. You can never get a good deal by force and coercion. You know how it is. It's a deal under duress. I keep saying this. A deal under duress is not a deal. Is simply a stalling tactic that will get you back to some further trouble down the line. And in this case, the dismantling of NATO.
Thank you very much, Andrew. And note that point. Andrew there in Springfield, in Oregon, in the United States. 0345-6060973. I have to say, John Bolton, as Jeff Hoon was saying, the former defense secretary, John Bolton knows the mind of the president clearly very well. I would suspect that this will not be the end of it, by the way. It's all very well, Donald Trump, sort of with this rhetoric saying Iran has overstepped the mark and that they've now stopped the killing. I suspect he's not going to sort of kiss and make up with the Ayatollah and leave this to one side. Clearly something is going to happen, I would ascertain. I'm just not sure what that looks like yet. Mohammed's in Edgware. Hi, Mohammed.
Hi, Henry. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you for calling in.
Thank you. Well, as an Iranian artist, I sing mostly rap, which is to do with human rights and the current situation in Iran for more than 25 years, living in the UK. And I am also a human rights activist. So what I see from my perspective is that obviously war cannot be really a solution. The reason is, I mean, previous callers mentioned about Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan. It's going to be very difficult. And the regime actually loves that because they are always blaming US, UK, Israel for everything happening inside Iran, which is obviously not true because people are fed up with this regime. 70% is poverty and inflation, 40%. Mm. So the economy is literally destroying everyone's life today.
Yes.
So, perhaps you might ask, what is the solution then, right? At this moment, what can we do? I think we have enough people. I don't know if you heard about resistance units. Those are the ones who made this recent uprising radical. It started from a bazaar in Tehran.
Yeah.
And then this young generation, even if you look at the people that have been killed in this the last 2 weeks, they're all majority of them below 30 years old. They're all young. They want to be free, like British people, like many other Western countries. But the solution is we can support them by, first of all, I think blacklisting IRGC will literally inject some hope to the society that, look, British government, Western government doing something. I think this is a very first step. Secondly, close down their embassies. I think that's also very helpful.
Yes.
And expel all the agents. I mean, they are terrorists. Bunch of you know, people that are coming to UK.
Embassies, though, I mean, we have got people detained in Iran who are British citizens, we have to bear in mind as well.
Well, of course, but to be honest, what can we do? There are always, regime is using British people, other citizens as a bargaining chip. It's not for the first time, and it's not going to be the last time.
What do you want to see from the US now, Mohammed? I mean, because Donald Trump has spoken tough in recent days.
Yeah, to be honest, inside Iran, there are many people, they already have weapons. They can defend themselves on the, you know, Universal Declaration of Human Rights and all international laws. When the regime becomes so oppressive and killing people, you can self-defense, right? So I think President Trump and Western countries should recognize and mention, all right, Iranian people, you have the right to go and defend yourself. And we support that. There's nothing wrong with it. If you have guns, if you want to fight back, because the regime, come on, they're not going to stop killing people. They're not going to stop executing people. And in fact, as we're going forward, it's getting worse. So I think we also have a very organized, opposition group, NCRI. I don't know for how many years. I mean, literally 47 years, they are fighting nonstop with the regime. Mrs. Rajavi, she's got 4,000 parliamentarians behind her. She's got more than 600 MPs and peers in the UK. She's got 105 Nobel Prize winners. But this needs to also be approved by the, Western governments, that the Iranian resistance units inside Iran are willing to do what the West is trying. They are willing to defend themselves. But they need support. And this is what we can do. And to be honest, having someone like I can see on the media, people talking about Reza Pahlavi being an option, he literally cannot do anything for the Iranian people. It's not because I don't like him, nothing personal, because he doesn't have an organization.
Okay. Thank you, Mohammed. Nice to hear your perspective as well as an Iranian artist. Very welcome, so thank you. More calls in a moment. 0345 6060973 when it comes to Iran. Also,
if we don't go in, Russia's going to go in and China's going to go in. And there's not a thing that Denmark can do about it.
It's not just Iran. Donald Trump now continuing to say that he wants Greenland after the foreign ministers of Greenland and Denmark enter the White House today. We'll speak with Donald Trump's former US ambassador to Denmark next. 10:30 is the time. The news with Daryl Jackson.
There are growing calls for the head of West Midlands Police to be sacked over a decision to ban Israeli football fans from a match in Birmingham. Craig Guildford insists the decision to stop Maccabi Tel Aviv fans from attending a game at Aston Villa wasn't politically motivated, but a report found the risk posed by supporters had been overstated by the force. The US president says he's been told that killings in Iran's crackdown on nationwide protests are stopping. Donald Trump says he believes there's currently no plan for large-scale executions, even as tensions between Iran and Washington remain high. And Denmark says fundamental disagreements remain with the US on Greenland after meeting officials in Washington. Donald Trump's threatened to take over the Danish-controlled territory. LBC weather. Heavy rain and strong winds moving into southern England and Wales tomorrow. A mix of cloud and isolated showers for western Scotland, a high of 10 degrees.
LBC, coming up on Nick Ferrari at Breakfast.
Coming up tomorrow morning with Nick Ferrari at Breakfast, yet another U-turn, but Keir Starmer claims they are turning the corner in a new party political broadcast. So does the nation agree? Nick will have a live report from one of Labour's safest seats. Plus, he'll also bring you the latest on the possibility of a US strike on Iran. And who should be sacked first? The West Midlands Police Chief Constable Craig Guildford or the South East Worcester Chief Executive Dave Hinton? All of that and much more coming up with Nick Ferrari at Breakfast tomorrow morning from 7 here on LBC.
Nick Ferrari at Breakfast. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app. LBC.
Live and love to the last breath. This January, fall in love with the passion, drama, and heartbreak of the iconic opera that inspired Pretty Woman and Moulin Rouge. Experience the Royal Opera's grand production of La Traviata from the 8th of January to the 17th of February at the Royal Opera House. Get great seats from just £23. Don't miss La Traviata. Book now at rbo.org.uk.
The following is from TfL.
My name was Luna, like the moon. I was 2 days short of my 17th birthday when I was killed. My killer wasn't a bad man. He had a rescue dog called Frank and rang his mum every Sunday. He wasn't a speed freak. He just thought it was okay to go a few miles an hour over the limit. But that was enough to knock me off my bike and kill me.
Speeding injures or kills over 1,000 people in London every year. Slow down. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
Hi, just leaving work now. Sorry it's a bit loud. Basically, so I was thinking we could get Mackey's tonight. Had a Big Mac on my mind all day, and delivery fee on the app is now from 99p. So, you in? Of course you are. Ha, love you. Bye.
Exclusively on the McDonald's app. 18 plus. Service fee and small order fee may apply. Participating restaurants. Serving times and T's and C's apply.
Henry Reilly on LBC. Text 84850.
Back to Iran in a moment. First, though, crucial meetings taking place in the White House today with the Denmark and Greenlandic foreign ministers. This was the foreign minister of Denmark, Lars Løkke Rasmussen.
We had what I will describe as a frank but also constructive discussion. The discussions focused on how to ensure the long-term security in Greenland. And here our perspectives continue to differ, I must say. The president has made his view clear, and we have a different position. We, the Kingdom of Denmark, continue to believe that also the long-term security of Greenland can be ensured inside the current framework.
Lars Løkke Rasmussen, the foreign minister of Denmark, speaking after that meeting with J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio, the secretary of state. Also in the meeting was the Greenlandic foreign minister, Vivian Motzfeldt.
I think it's very important to say it again, that how important it is from our side to strengthen our cooperation with the United States, but that doesn't mean that we want to be owned by the United States.
And speaking afterwards, President Trump.
Well, we're going to see what happens with Greenland. We need Greenland for national security, so we're going to see what happens. They're going to brief me on the meeting right after this conference. In fact, the sooner I get you out, the faster I'm going to know exactly what happened. But we have a very good relationship with Denmark, as you know. We'll see. But, you know, we're doing the Golden Dome. We're doing a lot of things, and we really need it. If we don't go in, Russia's going to go in, and China's going to go in. And there's not a thing that Denmark can do about it, but we can do everything
there's
about
no
it.
There's no more thing what they can do there?
Well, we're going to see. I mean, look, we're going to see what happens, but we need it. You know, I'm not the first one.
Donald Trump speaking earlier on. Let's bring into the conversation Carla Sands, who was the U.S. ambassador to Denmark during Trump's first presidency, now chair of foreign policy at the America First Policy Institute. And Carla Sands joins me now. Thank you, Ambassador Sands, for joining us. When Donald Trump says there's not a thing they can do about it with regards to Denmark, it's not particularly diplomatic language, is it?
Well, I don't think Denmark's been particularly diplomatic. I mean, the prime minister hasn't picked up the phone and called President Trump in a year. Instead, she took a tour all over Europe trying to get European leaders to backstop her and say, no, no, no. You know, the U.S. has no right to do anything in Greenland, but Greenland's part of North America. Denmark cannot defend it, has never been able to defend it, and that means they're in violation of the NATO Charter. Article 3 says that every NATO ally has the ability to defend their own territory.
When it comes to U.S. presence there, there used to be 15,000 American troops, there used to be multiple military bases, there's now one. Why not just expand there? I mean, the Greenlandic politicians say that's fine, have as many troops as you want.
Well, that's because we occupied it. The United States occupied Greenland during World War II, and we left after the fall of the Berlin Wall and turned everything over to Denmark. We didn't have to do that, but we did. Denmark hasn't shown that they're willing to step up. In 2019, President Trump talked to the current prime minister, Mette Frederiksen, and said, look, Greenland's not secure. You've got Greenland, you need to secure it. And she said, I'm going to invest $200 million in security for Greenland, for the region. And do you know what she spent? 1%, $2 million, sure. And it wasn't sure. Even on security. You cannot believe what she says. She's not going to.
But why not just station U.S. troops there, Carla Sands? I mean, they're saying that's fine. You can have as many as you want.
Why would we defend Denmark's territory? They can't. It's like when you own a home or a building and you can't afford to own that asset. You have to sell it. They can't afford to develop it. They just send a little welfare every year, but nothing happens. It's like kind of out of sight, out of mind for the Danes. They want their tax dollars going to their benefits, their social welfare programs. They like them. They pay a lot of taxes. And this prime minister has delivered on those things, but she hasn't delivered for the Greenlanders. And Greenland, the people there, and I've talked to them, they want prosperity. They want security. They want to have a great life and be able to live their dream. They will never get there with Denmark. They can't afford to.
Should they get a say, though? I mean, if there is a U.S. offer made financially, it should be up to them, the 50-odd thousand people who live there. Do you agree?
So the Greenlanders do want to determine their own future, and they have said that they're going independent. So in the 20th century, Iceland left the Kingdom of Denmark and went independent. Greenland will leave in the 21st century. President Trump is saying, great, but we're not going to let you fall into the hands of China or Russia. And that, I mean, the Greenlanders have openly said to me, we don't care who invests in our country, China, U.S., money has no color.
Sure, but respectfully, who is President Trump to say that? They don't want to align themselves with the United States. They want to be independent.
So Europe benefits, and the U.S. does, from the warning system, as does Canada there in the north of Greenland that the U.S. military runs. It's called Pitifix Space Base, and it's part of our defense. It's now going to be part of Golden Dome. Along with Alaska, Greenland will be part of that defense, and that benefits us, but it benefits our allies, too. If Greenland falls into enemy hands, we couldn't get to Europe or the U.K. to even come to the aid of our allies. If an adversary controlled it, it would be land and air and sea that would be compromised for the U.S. and for our allies. So this is to the benefit of the U.S., but also Europe and U.K.
Well,
and
not to the NATO alliance, though, if the Danes put up a fight, Carla Sands.
So the NATO alliance will be just fine. Denmark has never kept their promises to the NATO alliance. They have, as long as I was there, they had a failing report card from NATO. Hopefully they're doing better now. But the fact is that once President Trump leaves office or the Ukraine war ends, a lot of these allies are going to be peeling back what they committed to the defense because they just don't want to pay it.
You've got to go, but last question. How do you think this ends, Carla Sands? Will it end in some sort of financial package in your view, and how quickly could we see that?
Well, I don't know if it ends in a financial package. I mean, if it did, President Trump would go down in history like our U.S. President Thomas Jefferson, who did the Louisiana Purchase. But I'm not sure. Maybe it's kind of a COFA, like a free association, because the Greenlanders want to be independent. They want to elect their own leaders. So maybe there's an investment and security guarantee along with that association. But it will to be determined. The fact that they didn't have a presser after that meeting means that the Danes and Greenlanders understand the seriousness of this moment.
I'm grateful for your time. Thank you. Carla Sands was the U.S. ambassador to Denmark during President Trump's first time in office and is chair of foreign policy at the America First Policy Institute. You might have views on that. Back to Iran, though. John's in Newcastle. Hello, John.
Hello, Henry. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, good. What would you like to say?
Just a question. Do you think Donald Trump's been a help or a hindrance with the carry-on in Iran?
What, this time or over the course of him being president?
By this time. I mean, encouraging protesters to go on the street.
I think
no one being killed.
Well, I think it's a good thing to have people. I mean, the regime there, John, is poison. So I think if people are standing up to
yes,
it, that's,
yes.
that's a good thing, people standing up to their regimes. I also, of course, I don't want people to be killed, so.
But, you know, you've got to ask yourself how many people have been on them streets listening to him and who have been killed.
Does that not show how desperate they are, though, John? 2,500 have been killed.
They're desperate. But he's not helping the situation.
Well, you might think that. So, I mean, he's ramped up the rhetoric in recent days. How else should he have responded?
Yeah, he's talking the talk, but he's actually doing nothing.
But what do you want him to do? I mean, he's telling people to get out there and protest, which is half of the battle, and then he's threatening military strikes, and no one's happy. So what do you want him to do?
The thing is, he's just released a statement and he's saying all the killings are being stopped. How does he know that?
Because he has had assurances from the Iranians, is his view, and he's
you can't trust them people, can you?
Well, I would agree with that, and certainly it's also not good enough to say, well, they've stopped killing people now after 2,500 people have been killed.
It makes you wonder how many people who've been imprisoned through this situation.
Well, loads as well.
Listen,
well,
I don't know what them people are, right? They're pure evil. And the sooner they're out of that country, the better. Because the Iranian people deserve better.
Well, I agree with that. Thank you, John, in Newcastle. Edgar's in Dover. Hello, Edgar.
Hi, thanks for having me on after such an impressive caller that you've had in.
They're all impressive. I'm sure you'll be equally as impressive, Edgar.
Oh,
come on.
I don't know about that. It's a tough act to follow. My two cents. I don't particularly like Donald Trump. I think he's a moron. But I really do hope he goes through with this. I mean, the people of Iran deserve better. The culture from way back, it's a secular society, not one run by these mullahs. I think there's also an advantage for us in terms of if he does go into Iran and goes after those factories that manufacture drones and the equipment that Iran is supplying to Russia as well, that would hurt them. It would hurt Putin as well, and, you know, maybe get him to sit down and talk. And at the end of the day, I think the person that's going to influence him the most is going to be Netanyahu. I think it's going to be
Israeli. Well, we know where Netanyahu sits on the regime in Iran, of course, and the mullahs. But
yeah,
you do think this will end in some form of military strike, in your view, Edgar?
I do. Well, he's done it before, you know, so I don't see him being scared of going back again, no matter what happened in Venezuela.
And what of those previous instances, though, where he's seen it, I mean, to be blunt, not work out particularly well and leave a country in more chaos?
I mean, sometimes, you know, you need to suffer a little bit. I mean, we only got the rights we have after people tarred and feathered. But, you know, here we are. So maybe it's a sacrifice that the nation is going to have to make for their freedom. I mean, no government has ever given you any rights.
Well, thank you very much, Edgar, in Dover. Very impressive caller. You a tough act to follow, but you did very well. Thank you. More calls in a moment. 0345-6060-973 is the number to call to have your say on Iran and what the US should do. And we'll be continuing to state your views on this throughout the rest of the programme. Plus, Front Pages next. It's 10:45.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
The Chief Constable of West Midlands Police, the one caught up in that row over misleading MPs over the use of AI. Be in no doubt, the decision by West Midlands Force to ban the fans from that team, that Maccabi Tel Aviv team, showed how the hardline elements in the Muslim community were able to drown out the concerns of Jewish people in that area. I have to tell you, my friends, anti-Semitism is alive and very well currently in this country, and precious few are doing much about it. And coming back to that copper, I'm not suggesting he's an anti-Semite, by the way. I'm not suggesting that. I'm suggesting he's just not up to it. He deceived Parliament. He's delusional to think that he can stay in his job.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
Go on, leave the never-ending laundry pile, quiet flat, and empty fridge at home. Hop on the train and go into the workplace zone with Southeastern. Whether you're heading in for a change of scene, to share ideas, or enjoy a lunchtime chat with your colleagues, with our great range of tickets, we've got the one to suit your commute. Buy yours now on our app or website and pay no booking fees. So, go on, go in.
Southeastern. Chase is the digital bank you can count on.
How so?
Because you get 1% cash back on your grocery shop.
Like on prosciutto?
Yeah, prosciutto.
And seaweed crackers?
Sure, those two.
Well, hang on, what about rotisserie chickens?
If it's in your grocery shop, Chase has got your cash back. Join today and get 1% cash back on debit card spending on groceries, fuel and everyday transport. Chase, see what your money can do. 18 plus UK residents eligibility applies. 1% cash back for your first year. Maximum £15 per month. Exceptions apply.
Hi babe, what a day. Fancy staying in tonight instead? Mackie's calling my name and I saw you can get £5 off if you spend £20 on the app. So you in? Of course you are. Okay, bye.
Exclusively on the McDonald's app. Save £5 when you spend £20 on food and drink via delivery. T's and C's apply. 18 plus. Service and delivery fees apply. Valid once per week, 1st to the 31st of January. Participating restaurants. Serving times apply.
You want £1 million.
I'd love £1 million.
So you enter the birthday draw.
It's a very personal draw, so you think of a personal way to spend £1 million.
I would hire a hype man, so everything I do would suddenly be epic.
It's a lucky day, and you win the birthday draw, so...
Let's go, Kev! Goat cheese bagel for lunch! Woohoo!
This could get tiresome.
Is it your lucky day? Search the birthday draw and enter now. From Global and ITV, 18 plus UK only, no purchase necessary.
This is LBC. Message Henry Riley on WhatsApp now. 0345 60 60 973.
Is this the calm before the storm in your view, and the US will launch airstrikes into Iran, or will seek to form some sort of military action in order to get the mullahs, the Ayatollah in particular, out and to end that poisonous regime? What do you think happens next? 0345 6060 973 is the number to call. Coming up after 11, by the way, we're going to talk about Craig Guildford, who's the Chief Constable of West Midlands Police. I mean, to say he's a bungling chief, police chief would be an understatement. I mean, he's been proven in many cases to have told mistruths to Parliament. He doesn't know how AI works. The reports that they've used were, I mean, to say not credible, again, would be a massive understatement. No one has confidence in him. The Home Secretary has no confidence in him. All of the opposition parties have no confidence in him. Everyone wants him to go. The only people who want him to stay seemingly are him and the Police and Crime Commissioner, for some inexplicable reason, has decided not to fire him. I mean, what more do they need to know? Anyway, we'll come to that in a bit. Front pages of the newspapers, understandably, that story featured on the front of the Times. Fan row, police chief won't quit. The head of the West Midlands Force lawyering up after the Home Secretary calls for resignation over decision to ban Israeli supporters. There was also a story at the time. He says he's been unfairly treated, Craig Guildford. There we go. The Daily Telegraph, 4 million denied the right to vote. The Prime Minister running scared of public with 24 councils poised to cancel elections. The Daily Mail, a big picture of Craig Guildford on their front page. Shameless, a scathing report condemns West Midlands Police's lies over decision to ban Israeli football fans. I'm quoting here, the Home Secretary declares she's lost confidence in the under-fire police chief, but astonishingly, he refuses to resign. The Guardian, Trump still intent on conquering Greenland, say Danes after talks. And we spoke with Carla Sands a little bit earlier on, the former US ambassador under Trump there. The Daily Express, let's honour nation's injured 999 heroes. A former PC shot in the face by a robber has backed the Express's campaign to honour those injured in service. The Mirror, world on the brink, foreign sec, we stand ready to take on Russia. The US and UK military prepare for Iran strikes and retaliation. The Sun, Cheryl Stalker nicked again. Cheryl Tweedy's stalker has been back in the news. He's freed again after 3 months, and now he's been rearrested, so say the paper, the Metro. This is interesting. One small step to reception. A space entrepreneur backed by Elon Musk has unveiled plans for the first hotel on the moon. The Daily Star, His Royal Skyness... They've found builders are installing premium satellite TV at the home of Prince Andrew. I mean, come on. And the Financial Times carries very important comments from Rachel Reeves. Rachel Reeves has opened the door to expanding her business rates U-turn beyond pubs to other hospitality businesses. I mean, another day, another government U-turn. Last week, they said when they were U-turning on pubs, well, we won't U-turn on other businesses. They will still pay the rate. And now... hotels and cafes are going to pay the same business rates. Is everything under control? Milad is in Chiswick on the subject of Iran. Hello, Milad.
Hi, Henry. How are you doing?
Good, thank you, sir. What do you want to say?
Basically, okay, so the last 5 days have been terrible. I'm originally from Iran. My family's from Iran. And they emigrated.
Do you still have family there, can I ask?
And I still have family in Iran as well.
Have you been able to get any Starlink or anything?
No, I've heard that they're safe, but there are still family members I haven't been in touch with. And I think it's my duty. I'm sorry, you had a caller before, Mohammed from Edgware, who was talking straight waffle. So I just wanted to, if you afford me the opportunity.
Okay, go on then.
So he was talking about the MEK as an opposition group that can take control. The MEK sided with Saddam Hussein in the Iran-Iraq war, and they've been designated as a terrorist organization. They have left-wing roots that originated in some kind of solidarity with the people early on, but that dissipated. And, you know, for me, as a student of my own history, and also as someone who's built a life for himself in a beautiful city like London, I just really very much like to just, I guess, alert the community as a whole who listen to LBC about just exactly what's up for discussion. So so basically, Donald Trump, I think, has two routes to go. One is that he follows the advice of, I guess, the Israelis and the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
And attacks with the intention of replacing or giving the military, who at this point have not sided, they haven't gotten involved, right? So it's with the position of getting the military to then basically get rid of the Islamic Republic of Iran with the consensus of foreign interference, to then bring in a constitutional monarchy, much like the one that was there previous to the Islamic Republic. And I think that between anti-imperialist left academics and journalists and a lot of people listening, they'll be saying, well, foreign interference is not something I want my country to be getting involved in.
Yeah.
And to which I would say, if anyone reads history, so the Shah of Iran, when he left in about 1978, for the
79.
It was between 78
and 78. Sure, yes. Okay, fair enough.
So it was actually earlier in 78, coming into 79.
Well done.
He left because he didn't want to basically create a bloody handover.
Yes.
What was left after that was basically like an open idea of what Iran could be. People were talking about republics. People were talking about what kind of governance. Mm-hmm. And remember, 70s Iran, it's a very bourgeois time. Academics, Jean-Paul Sartre, all these people are like rolling around in Iran. And there's a lot of ideas about the positive change that could happen. The Islamists have basically aligned with the leftists. And the French actually chartered Ayatollah Khomeini on an Air France flight privately. So there's always been an element of foreign interference that has unfortunately plagued the country that I'm from the 53 coup.
Right. Can I take you to today, though? What needs to happen now?
So that's the one route that I think Trump is not going towards. And I think the last hour, the development that has come where Trump was sitting at his desk in the Oval Office and basically said, they're going to stop the executions. That is the out that I think Donald Trump was looking for, because on the other side of the table, there's Qatar, there's Saudi Arabia, there's the UAE, there's the GCC countries, the Gulf countries, who want nothing more than to keep the Islamic Republic of Iran and to keep some semblance of stability, even if it means the massacre of 12,000 the number has not been verified.
2,500 is the latest, but you're right, it's not verified.
2,500, and the BBC Persian Service have been doing a phenomenal job, but I think at the same time, because they cannot verify, we do not know. So on the question of foreign interference, okay, we've got two sides of the coin. Israel Republicans, they might bring in a constitutional monarchy, which can at the very least, and there is popularity home and abroad.
Led by Reza Pahlavi.
You see, the thing is, Iranians understand a bipolar world. They understand figureheads. They understand Ayatollah, or they understand constitutional monarchy. Now, you see, we're so proud of my nation. We're very intelligent, very, very like heads on our next nation that really understand the kind of the nuances of governance and society. So no one is saying that they want the constitutional monarch to come and reign. What they're saying is, anything is better than being mowed down by militias who have been sent in by the Islamic Republic of Iran from their allies, be it Hezbollah or Iraq. These people are coming in with semi-automatic machine guns and they are spraying bullets indiscriminately. So the reality of the situation is we've got an internet blackout. We've got a regime that is lacking in legitimacy.
Yep.
And we also have this really, really, this kind of catch-22, where on both sides, you've got players in the region who have access and have lobbied Trump to the point where he's going to basically flip a coin and says, maybe I'm going to do it, maybe I'm not going to do it. The time right now for Iranians across, and you know, we've been asking all of the people we know in the UK, in the US, in Europe, all the places where internet is still open. We're basically saying, listen, there's 90 million people who are stuck without internet access, without telephone lines, be their voice. It's the most desperate situation for these people. And I understand, again, I understand anti-imperialist theology. I understand the history of the Western world when it's come to Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya. And the one thing I can tell you, hand on heart, is that Iran is not going to follow the same path. Because with Iran, you have a population of 90 million, some of the most literate, tech-savvy. You've got doctors, lawyers, you've got the greatest minds in the world. We've got the biggest brain drain to the extent that every young professional, once they end up leaving the top universities, once they get the opportunity, they leave. And they basically, they live, and for every, I know LBC is the most listened to radio station in the whole of the United Kingdom. If I ask your viewers and your listeners right now, do you know someone of Persian descent? Have you ever had a positive interaction with someone from Iran, a Persian person? You know, your phone lines are going to go out absolutely off the chain. Why?
Of course they are, and you're quite right. Milad, thank you. You had a good go at it there, and I'm grateful that you called in. Thank you. In Chiswick, we will return to this matter, but we are going to move on. Coming up,
the ultimate responsibility for the force's failure to discharge its duties on a matter of such national importance rests with the Chief Constable.
The bungling Chief Constable of the West Midlands Police is still inexplicably in his job despite having lost support from just about everybody. Also,
he's giving himself leeway. I think he's prepared for either eventuality. I think that's what the evacuation of U.S. and U.K. diplomatic personnel from various posts around the region indicates. And my guess is he'll wake up tomorrow morning and decide what to do.
Ambassador John Bolton speaking with me earlier on about Iran. We'll come back to that. And later on after midnight, we'll be talking about cycling, with new traffic lights and pedestrian crossings introduced to curb excessive speed. What is not to like?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock. There are increasing calls for the head of West Midlands Police, Craig Guildford, to go after the Home Secretary said she'd lost confidence in him. A police watchdog investigation into the force's ban of Israeli football fans from a match in Birmingham found the risk posed by supporters was overstated. Dr. Timothy Brain, former Assistant Chief Constable of West Midlands Police, told LBC the Chief Constable has questions to answer.
If I was in his position, I'd have to go through my own decision-making processes. What have I said? What have I done? Would it be kinder on my reputation to go sooner than to be dismissed?
The US president says he's been told that killings in Iran's crackdown on nationwide protests are stopping. Donald Trump says he believes there's currently no plan for large-scale executions. He threatened to attack Iran if the regime went ahead with executing anti-government protesters. Ambassador John Bolton, former US national security advisor in Trump's first administration, told LBC he isn't sure if there's been a change in tact from the president.
Say no decision with Trump is final until it's final. And I think he's prepared for either eventuality. I think that's what the evacuation of U.S. and U.K. diplomatic personnel from various posts around the region indicates. My guess is he'll wake up tomorrow morning and decide what to do.
Denmark and Greenland's foreign ministers say they've had frank and constructive discussions with the US after Donald Trump's threats to take control of the island. They say the two sides still have different perspectives on Greenland's future. Carla Sands, US ambassador to Denmark during Trump's first presidency, told LBC the US taking over Greenland would benefit allies.
If Greenland falls into enemy hands, we couldn't get to Europe or the UK to even come to the aid of our allies. If an adversary controlled it, it would be land and air and sea that would be compromised for the US and for our allies.
Sir Keir Starmer's told MPs the UK will not back down over reports Elon Musk's AI chatbot is being used to make fake images on X. But the Prime Minister says he welcomes reports the social media platform's taking steps to comply with the law. Arsenal have a 3-2 lead after the first leg of their EFL Cup semi-final against Chelsea this evening. The second leg is at the Emirates Stadium at the start of next month. LBC weather. Heavy rain and strong winds moving into southern England and Wales tomorrow. Isolated showers in western Scotland, a high of 10 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Daryl Jackson.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Henry Reilly.
Good evening to you. 3 minutes past 11 is the time. You're listening to Henry Reilly here on LBC. Lovely to have your company. Talking this hour, we will return to Iran, by the way, and if there is any update with that, we will bring it to you first here on LBC. But big domestic news, and as I mentioned, it's on the front page of all of the newspapers, tomorrow's newspapers, the situation with Craig Guildford. Now, to remind you, he's the chief constable, still the chief constable, somehow, of West Midlands Police. And, I mean, the most extraordinary evidence has come to light, and he is clinging to his job by his fingernails, and quite how, I'm not sure, because he's lost the faith of the Home Secretary. He's lost the confidence of the Home Secretary, and has somehow stayed in his job. I don't quite understand how you have the brass neck to remain as a chief constable when your boss, effectively, the Home Secretary, is saying that you should go. We now learn that Craig Guildford, sources or allies close to him are saying he feels unfairly treated. Give me a break. If you're the chief constable, you have to take full responsibility. He's now reportedly lawyering up after the Home Secretary called for his resignation over the decision to ban Israeli supporters. He is resisting pressure to resign despite losing the confidence of Shabana Mahmood. Craig Guildford said to be lawyering up after she called for him to go in the House of Commons. This was all regarding, you may recall, a decision to ban Israeli fans from travelling to a Maccabi Tel Aviv game against Aston Villa. Was back in November, a damning report that has also come out. This is an interim report. And by the way, this isn't from the government or this isn't from some sort of biased organisation. This is from Sir Andy Cook, a former chief constable who's now His Majesty's Inspector of Constabulary. His report found that the force had retrofitted exaggerated and untrue evidence to justify the ban, misleading public statements they also made, and they failed to properly engage with the Jewish community. Shabana Mahmood said there'd been a failure of leadership, and somehow he is still in his job. This a man, by the way, who came onto LBC and appeared this tough talking copper. He was speaking with my colleague Nick Ferrari in August, and Nick asked him, what makes a good copper?
Chief Constable, what makes a good copper?
Probably three or four key things, really. Number one, decent moral compass, the ability to make the right judgment. Number two, not to be judgmental. We're not judge and jury. We gather the evidence, we produce it for the court. And I think number three, the ability to communicate on people's level and to remember that sometimes people are ringing the police, and when we interact with them, it's the first time ever that they've had to do such a thing. And that's important that we get that right. Even if it's the 15th repetitive job that the cop's been to, it's the best service we can give. That's what it's all about. Public service, and public service first.
Craig Guildford speaking with LBC in August. Hasn't aged well, that, has it? Having a decent moral compass, the ability to make the right judgments, none of those seem to be qualities that we've seen in the Chief Constable of West Midlands. And I emphasise that. I was really expecting when I came on tonight to say the former Chief Constable of West Midlands, but he's still in his job, even after performances like this at the Home Affairs Select Committee.
It's within my narrative that I've compiled over the weekend. The one assertion in relation to the West Ham is completely wrong. That's as a result, I'm told, of some social media scraping that was done, and that is wrong. That was one element in a document which was 89 pages long. But the key tenets in the document
So you did what? An AI search and you got something about West Ham and just whacked it into the...
No, not at all. We do a very comprehensive assessment. Some of that we get from partners, other football clubs, the UK policing unit, our own intelligence collection. And we also search through social media to see what's trending, what are the posts, who's following the posts, etc., etc. So it was as a result of that.
You still hold the line that no AI tools were used in the preparation?
Yeah, I've just got a note about that as well, because in your letter you asked as well around the... some of the background of the information and the intelligence which we've provided, and there was a definite note that we've got to the bottom of in terms of
the West Ham game. And I think the accusation, well, not the accusation, the summation, I think, in the House, it was a question that was asked in the House, was that, you know, you've used AI, or West Midlands may have used AI on this particular occasion. We don't do that. We don't use the AI.
We don't use the AI. I mean, give me a break. This is the charge sheet. Let's just be absolutely clear. He said that Jewish groups were consulted on the decision to ban Maccabi Tel Aviv fans. They weren't. He said he relied on intel from Dutch police. The mayor of Amsterdam and the various politicians in the Dutch government have contradicted that. He also said the force hadn't used AI. It now emerges they did use AI because they were referring to a match between Maccabi Tel Aviv and West Ham, which never took place because they used the first result on Google AI. Is everything really under control in the West Midlands? Clearly not, so says the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood.
We have witnessed a failure of leadership that has harmed the reputation and eroded public confidence in West Midlands police and policing more broadly. Faced by a game of such importance, the Chief Constable of the Force, Craig Guildford, should have ensured more professional and thorough work was done. As Sir Andy himself says, the shortcomings detailed in his report are, and I quote, symptomatic of a force not applying the necessary strategic oversight and not paying enough attention to important matters of detail, including at the most senior levels. The ultimate responsibility for the force's failure to discharge its duties on a matter of such national importance rests with the Chief Constable.
Unequivocal there from Shabana Mahmood. In a moment, I'll play you what Chris Philp, the Shadow Home Secretary, told my colleague Andrew Marr. First, though, can bring into the conversation Sir Michael Ellis, the former Conservative MP and Attorney General. Thank you, Sir Michael. He's lost the support of everyone. Are you surprised that he's still in his job?
Yes, I'm very surprised, and you're right. He has lost the support of everyone. The reality is it's completely untenable for any Chief Constable to remain in place once they've lost the confidence of the Home Secretary. That is completely untenable. It's been 20 years since a Home Secretary last said he or she did not have confidence in a Chief Constable. We cannot have a functioning situation where a Chief Constable insists on remaining in place when the Home Secretary has said that that shouldn't be the case. So I think, you know, this is actually now as if the what has not, you know, what has been happening with the West Midlands Police is in itself a crisis for UK policing. We're now in a situation where this is probably the biggest crisis in UK policing for many years.
What is the charge sheet levied at the Chief Constable, so far as you see it, Sir Michael?
Well, the charge sheet, as far as the Chief Inspector of His Majesty's Constabulary has found it, is that they encountered a lack of balance, is how he put it, Sir Andy. He said that they should and could have been prepared more effectively. He spoke about carelessness. This is a situation where, actually, it does reflect rather well on Parliament, if I can put it that way, Henry, that it's actually Parliament at its best, what we've seen here over the last 4 months. Mm. Thanks to the investigations of a cross-party group of members of Parliament, diligent members of Parliament on the Home Affairs Select Committee. And it's also a reflection of rather good journalism, if I can just add that, particularly from the Sunday Times. Mm. But what we really have a problem here is that the police have lost the confidence of a section of the community, as well as of the political arena, and that's just not a tenable situation. This is a situation where AI-generated fictitious football game has been cited, where, you know, there has been an incorrect claim which alleged that the Jewish community in Birmingham had lobbied for the ban on this football team. And there have also been suggestions that claims about disorder in Amsterdam more than a year ago that was used to support this decision was victim blaming of the actual victims, the Jews, who were in Amsterdam at the time. So, you know, the Maccabi fans. So the charge sheet is quite a significant one.
Well, I remember talking about it on the day which it happened, which is in November, and people were telling me that subsequently that Maccabee Tel Aviv fans were pushing people in canals, and it turns out there was only one person thrown in a canal who ended up in a canal, and they were actually a fan of Maccabee Tel Aviv.
That's exactly right, and so that is classic victim blaming, and that's never been stood up, as the Chief Inspector of Constabulary has pointed out. There's also suggestions about fans being members of the IDF and numbers of police officers that were required, which the Dutch police themselves, you know, have said is wrong. So here we have a situation where an English police force is saying what happened in Amsterdam differently from what the Amsterdam police force themselves are saying. So I don't see how that is tenable, and it's completely ridiculous that any chief constable could continue to stay in place without the confidence of any Home Secretary. And then, of course, we've got this situation where there's a suggestion that the Home Secretary does or does not have the power, and then that's become an interesting argument for lawyers like myself. But it nevertheless is one where you wouldn't expect to have to use the power after an announcement like the one Shabana Mahmood made today.
Of course. And as far as I see it, and I'm not an eminent legal expert like yourself, Sir Michael, but the Home Secretary previously had the power to intervene and sack a chief constable. Now they can basically tell the Police and Crime Commissioner to sack a chief constable. Noting that, though, I mean, I suppose we are getting rid of police and crime commissioners, but I mean, the Home Secretary really should have the power to sack anyone in policing since they've lost confidence, shouldn't they?
I think that's probably right, and she has said that she'll take that power back, and I don't think she'll have much dissent on that. But I think what's perhaps more interesting is that there is an argument that she does still have a power under the Police Act 1996, which is to issue a direction to the local policing body, in this case the Police and Crime Commissioner, to make a change. Now, the problem is the law the law as provided for by the statute of 1996 isn't absolutely clear about the powers there and what that exactly means, because it's never in 30 years been tested. But I think that the Home Secretary here could test that power and say, well, I'm giving a direction that the Chief Constable should be dismissed, if she wished to do that, and test that power out, as the Conservative shadow Home Secretary has said.
Yes, we haven't actually spoken about AI as well. There was a suggestion that there was a match that took place between West Ham and Tel Aviv that was Maccabee Tel Aviv, that was used as part of the argument. And it turns out they hadn't, that match, not only had it not taken place, they'd relied on Google AI, again, despite the Chief Constable, relating to what you said about Parliament, saying they hadn't used AI. I mean, this is someone who is in charge of one of the largest police forces in the country.
It's very worrying, Henry, and apparently, in the jargon, the AI had an hallucination. In other words, it made up this football match that was then relied upon. And of course, this has absolutely infuriated the Home Affairs Select Committee, where they were given this information. But I think this is a complete catalyst of error by West Midlands Police, and it reflects very badly on policing generally. We have to have confidence, as Shabana Mahmood eloquently was saying in the House of Commons today. To be quite frank, she was eloquent in her protection of the rights of all of us to have a police force in this country that we can, all of our communities can have confidence in. It's just that once you've lost the confidence of a section of the community, and I think this has gone now beyond any section or subsection of the community, once you've lost that confidence, I don't see how it's possible to continue. And I'm very concerned about this, which I do think, it's no exaggeration to say, this is definitely the biggest crisis in UK policing for many years.
Sir Andy Cook, who you referenced, who is the Chief Inspector of Constabulary, an independent voice who sort of looks at various police forces, does the big report at the end of every year. He's looked into this, and he does say that there was a conflation to say that the Maccabi Tel Aviv fans targeted Muslim communities, but he does say there was evidence that the fans targeted individual Muslims and pro-Palestinians. That clearly needs to be looked into. And when we do have fans, and there are some in Maccabi Tel Aviv, there are some in Chelsea and Arsenal and everywhere, you know, across the world. Clearly they were worried about some fans. Do you give any truck to that argument that clearly there were some bad actors like there are at every club?
Well, of course. I mean, if there are bad actors in any club, that has to be taken into consideration. I think all anyone looking at this fairly would want to do is to say, are you treating this example in the same way that you would treat any other example? And if you're not, what is the reason for that? So was it proportionate to act as they did in banning the entire team, the supporters from turning up? Was that something that they would have done had it been from in any other country? And that's one of the tests. Now, this is an interim report, as I understand it, from His Majesty's Chief Inspector of Constabulary, and he'll continue working on this and drilling into it. But I thought it's quite a temperate report. He doesn't use histrionic language, and he crosses his eyes, you know, crosses his T's, I should say, and dots his I's. But I think, you know, what we have here is enough, and as Shabana Mahmood herself described it, a devastating report where she felt that she could not continue to have confidence. And I think she was right to say that and right to have that view. And what happens now, we'll have to wait to see. But I think that it's a surprise that he's still in place, the chief constable, at this point.
And just lastly, when it comes to Jewish people living in the West Midlands, but I suppose this will have reverberations across the country, you described it as the biggest issue with policing at the moment, or one of the most significant. Just describe that and the impact that something like this will have if the chief constable remains in his place.
Well, you see, Henry, I think your listeners will bear in mind, because it's been part of the news cycle for so long now, that we've had, if we put this into context, we're constantly hearing allegations about the BBC and their broadcasting decisions. We're constantly hearing allegations about incidents within the National Health Service concerning the Jewish community. And government ministers, to be fair, have said that they want to do something about various disciplinary bodies that make up the functions of the NHS. There are various areas of our society, the public infrastructure of our society, which have led the Jewish community, I think, in this country to feel that they're not being supported. And this surely adds to that, because it gives an impression and creates a loss of confidence that equal decisions are being made for all. And sometimes it's the optics that are actually very important, as well as the reality. And I think I don't see how anyone could argue that the optics in this particular incident are extremely unfavourable. And that is a very loyally way of putting it, even if I say so myself. But I mean, that's the best way you can really describe it, is, you know, the optics are dreadful here. And the West Midlands Police have a lot of repair work to do.
Thank you for your time, Sir Michael Ellis, former Conservative Attorney General. Over to you now. Am I missing something, or is it not time for the Chief Constable of the West Midlands Police, given the Home Secretary is also calling for him, to go and go now?
This is LBC.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ADVICE to 78900 to find out more. That's ADVICE to 78900.
The following is from TfL.
I got loads of flowers the other day. And messages from people I didn't even know. My mates spelled out my name in tea lights. And my mom hung my favourite footy shirt on the railings, next to the lamppost, where I got killed. by a nice lady. Just someone who thought it was okay to go a few miles an hour over the limit.
Speeding injures or kills over 1,000 people in London every year. Slow down. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
The people of Britain love their spin bikes. They also love moving their card balances to a Barclaycard Platinum Balance Transfer Card with no interest for 36 months and £20 cash back until the 29th of January 2026. A balance transfer fee of 3.45% applies, subject to financial status. T's and C's and exclusions apply. Check if you're eligible at barclaycard.co.uk. Representative example, 24.9% APR representative variable and 24.9% purchase rate per annum based on a £1,200 credit limit.
Henry Reilly on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Jonathan says, can you let Henry Reilly know it was a game between Aston Villa and Tel Aviv, not West Ham, as has been said on numerous occasions? No, that's the point, Jonathan. It was Aston Villa versus Maccabi Tel Aviv, but the report, one of the reasons why they justified not having fans there was they cited a previous match between West Ham and Maccabi Tel Aviv that took place on the 9th of November 2023. The only problem is that game never took place. That just didn't happen. It's a mistake of a Google AI that the police relied on and for some reason didn't check. The report by the Inspector of Constabulary, by the way, also found the police response saw 5,000 officers deployed over a number of days. We found no evidence to substantiate that statement. With regards to the Netherlands, there was a figure, the 5,000 officers who were deployed because of what had happened when it was Maccabi Tel Aviv playing versus Ajax. That didn't happen. Over 200 were linked to the Israeli Defence Forces. The independent chief inspector, in his report, says that is incorrect. Can't be proven. They tore down Palestinian flags. The chief inspector found there was an instance where that happened, but the information is exaggerated, his words. The Dutch police told us one Palestinian flag had been pulled down. The day before, there were 600 Maccabi Tel Aviv fans targeting Muslim communities. The chief inspector says there was evidence that they targeted Muslims and pro-Palestinians, but they targeted individuals. They did not target the Muslim community generally. If you look at, for instance, this is the one that got me, that there were the Maccabi Tel Aviv fans throwing innocent members of the public into the canal and into the river in Amsterdam. This is inaccurate. The Dutch police have told us there was one person thrown in a canal and it was a Maccabi Tel Aviv supporter, apparently by members of a pro-Palestinian group. So says the chief inspector. Again, I mean, that whole report that we've seen is completely folded in front of our eyes. I don't really understand how he can remain in his job. I think he should probably gracefully bow out. But what do you think? 0345 6060 973. Simon's in Edgware. Hi, Simon.
Good evening. Just on the point of remove, we see Theresa May actually removed the authority of the Home Secretary to sack a chief constable, which now Maoist says he should reinstate. Now, there is Section 40 of the 1996 Act, Police Act, which your colleague, your guest mentioned. And Section 40 allows it gives the authority for the Home Secretary to compel the police commissioner, which would bring such enormous pressure, which probably would be able to push him out. But isn't it shameful? And in fact, that particular post I would abolish. I think they're a complete waste
of
money.
Well, they are going, aren't they, in fairness?
Yeah, well, they are going. You're quite right. They will be going.
If that's part of the reason why that particular police and crime commissioner doesn't want to play ball with his own party.
Well, also, if you look at Foster, Simon Foster, who is the current commissioner, of course, he's a big fan of Jeremy Corbyn. And, of course, under Jeremy Corbyn, we saw the worst cases of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party.
It
tells you everything you need to know.
Well, I mean, look, he was a big supporter of Jeremy Corbyn. You are right.
But coming back to this, and what we've had is, you already mentioned quite a few things. The chief constable clearly has been influenced by a section of very, very virulent anti-Semitic Islamists. We've seen this happen time and time again. The local MP, Mr. Khan, was elected not on environmental issues or concerns for local people, education, health. He was elected on one issue, Gaza, and he campaigned for weeks to try and get this match stopped. It is an underlying current of what I was, as a member of the Jewish community, I would say is a very virulent anti-Semitic tenure, which we're seeing across parts of this country. And it is shameful, really shameful, that this person, this chief counsel, would not have the, if he had an ounce of principle, he would resign. It is really quite amazing that he's just sitting there and he just doesn't get it. He's lied and lied and lied again. He tried to convince, he tried to say that one of the things that you haven't mentioned is that he tried to, he said that the members of my community, Jewish community, in that particular part of the country, he had consulted with him and said, no, they shouldn't come. Yeah, that was a lie, an outright lie.
He said they'd been consulted. You're quite right. No evidence to support that at all. Simon, thank you for getting that off your chest. Much appreciated. Anna's in Acton. Hello, Anna.
Oh, hello.
Hello.
Just one moment. Yeah, sorry. I'm here.
That's all right.
Hello.
Hello. Yes. Are you cooking or something? We interrupted you.
I didn't know I would come so quickly.
That's all right.
Let me just compose myself. Yeah,
okay.
I remember the thing that I remember when this was going on a few months ago or something like that.
Mm.
I made an effort and I looked on online on the, there was a video of the behavior of these fans, Maccabi fans. Was it Amsterdam?
It was,
or somewhere?
Yeah.
And I definitely saw violence, and I saw that, like, running on the street and attacking people, anybody who was passing by. And also, a particularly horrible chanting, why there are no children in Gaza, something like that, like we killed them or something like that.
The thing is, Anna, a lot of the claims that were made have been proven to be not true. There were claims that they tore down Palestinian flags.
Yeah.
Well, you'd have finished.
Yeah.
There was claims they tore down Palestinian flags. There was one example. Claims that they attacked police officers. One officer lost their hearing. There were claims that they're throwing members of the public into the canal. It didn't happen.
I didn't hear that about canal. What I saw was just what I saw. And I also remember that there was a comment about this clip that it was made not by the police, by an independent photographer, a lady, a woman. And when she made this clip, it was promptly, she was kind of reprehended. And I think she had to drop this or something like that. It seems like the government didn't want this to be seen. I'm absolutely sure about that. And there was an interview with her and she kind of said, yes, I made it, but I had some problems.
But Anna,
I
get that you've seen some videos online, but the independent chief inspector has said that the evidence was rubbish and that they, I mean, all of the reasons they gave for not having fans coming in from Israel was just not, couldn't be justified.
No, I could not have been wronged. It was so.
They said that they had consulted Jewish groups. They hadn't. They said that they.
Well,
had,
I don't know about that. I'm just talking about this, what they said.
They said that they relied on intelligence from Dutch police. They've contradicted that, the Dutch.
Can I just say something else?
All right.
I think this is an overreaction by a particular group, and also, is it Friends of Israel and so on, who I think make a mountain out of molehill very often, just almost like a prove a point. Because what is wrong in actually, you know, it's like preventing at that time the war in Gaza, the genocide was still going on. Sorry?
Did you say Iran you're talking about now?
No, in Gaza. I said the war in Gaza was still going on. And how can you expect there to be peaceful, you know, match and so on? I mean, all sorts of things have happened.
But it doesn't matter. They're still allowed to play football, Anna.
Yes, but, you know, it was... one thing is very unusual in that in the times of war, like Russia, they were not allowed to play anywhere, and even tennis, they had to take in independent states and so on.
Yeah, because they invaded a sovereign country.
Sorry?
Russia invaded a sovereign country.
What about Israel? What they have done?
I mean, let's not get into that. But thank you, Anna. Appreciate it. In Acton, more calls in a moment. First, though, the time is, in fact, coming up after the news.
If we don't go in, Russia's going to go in and China's going to go in. And there's not a thing that Denmark can do about it.
Back to Iran as the British embassy in Tehran closes. The U.S. pull personnel from a military base. We'll speak with a former senior advisor at the U.S. State Department. Next, 11:32 the time, the news with Daryl Jackson.
The head of West Midlands Police is facing growing pressure to go over a decision to ban Israeli football fans from a match at Aston Villa. Craig Guildford has denied it was politically motivated after a report found the risk of violence posed by Maccabi Tel Aviv was overstated. The US president says he's been told that killings in Iran's crackdown on nationwide protests are stopping. Donald Trump says he believes there's currently no plan for large-scale executions. Denmark and Greenland's foreign ministers say they've had frank and constructive discussions with the US vice president and secretary of state. But they say the two sides continue to have different perspectives on the Danish territory's long-term future. LBC weather, heavy rain and strong winds moving into southern England and Wales tomorrow. Isolated showers in western Scotland, a high of 10 degrees.
This is LBC.
Go on, leave the never-ending laundry pile, quiet flat and empty fridge at home. Hop on the train and go into the workplace zone with Southeastern. Whether you're heading in for a change of scene, to share ideas or enjoy a lunchtime chat with your colleagues. With our great range of tickets, we've got the one to suit your commute. Buy yours now on our app or website and pay no booking fees. So, go on, go in.
At Ocado, you'll save 25% on your first shop and get free delivery. Which means if you were to buy a four-cheese pizza, you'd basically be getting one of the cheeses for free. Save and splurge at Ocado, the online supermarket. Geographical and other restrictions. Minimum spend £60 and charges apply. New customers only. Maximum saving £20 terms at Ocado.com.
Find me somebody to love.
You'll love the Dreams Mega Clearance event. Shop now for up to 40% off. Dreams. Love your bed.
Big motoring world are big on value. But what does that mean for you? Well, we price check our cars every day, so we can give you the best price. Guaranteed. In fact, 95% of our cars are priced below market value. Big motoring world, we're big on value. See website for nearest store. Visit bigmotoringworld.co.uk or one of our stores for our price promise and terms and conditions.
This is LBC with Henry Riley. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
25 to 12 is the time. Talking about this incident that happened, or the fact that the Maccabi Tel Aviv fans were not allowed to go to the match against Aston Villa. It turns out the sort of dossier and the evidence used by the West Midlands Police has more sort of holes in it than Swiss cheese. There's so many different issues with it that have come through, and the Chief Constable there, Craig Guildford, is still in his job. Is that the right decision? 0345 60 60973 is the number to call. We'll come back to that in a moment. First, though, let's return to the big story with which we started, Iran. Earlier in the show, I spoke with Ambassador John Bolton, the former US National Security Advisor. He gave me his thoughts on what's happening at the moment. Your thoughts on what we've heard in the last few hours. Has there been a change in tact, do you sense, from the President? Good evening.
Good evening. Well, you know, he makes up his mind four or five times before he makes up his mind. We used to say no decision with Trump is final until it's final, and then even then it's not final. So I think he's giving himself leeway. I think he's prepared for either eventuality. I think that's what the evacuation of U.S. and U.K. diplomatic personnel from various posts around the region indicates. And my guess is he'll wake up tomorrow morning and decide what to do.
So you don't think it's imminent tonight? It's interesting. We had help is on the way that really dominated the news, those few words yesterday. Today he seems to be talking about the killing stopping and talking about the, individual sentence to the death penalty stopping. So you don't sense that is a change in heart? That's a temporary change, if anything.
Well, I think it's really hard to say. I mean, it could be tonight. You'll find out about it before most Americans because you'll get up earlier than we do. But I think it is important. Trump did draw red lines. And if he doesn't do anything about it, I think his credibility will be hurt. I think what you heard him doing was trying to erase the red lines, but in fact they're out there. And the regime, indeed, not just because of these 3 weeks of demonstrations, but for many, many fundamental reasons, in this case mostly the economy, is in terrible shape. I think the regime is very weak. I think it's vulnerable, and I'd hate to see the opportunity missed to take significant action that might well facilitate regime change.
John Bolton speaking with me earlier on, the former U.S. National Security Advisor under President Trump. Neeger Anger is former senior advisor at the U.S. State Department and the White House National Security under President Biden, and joins me now. Thank you for your time. What do you suspect is happening behind closed doors now with many of your former colleagues?
Well, thanks for having me on. I mean, look, the risk is inevitable, but it may not necessarily happen tonight, as you were just reporting on. I think, you know, a lot of the commentary that was made by the president during a press conference was a temporary off-ramp. Obviously, moving targets outside of or U.S. personnel out of the bases in Qatar and others is important. It's, you know, it's force protection, it's escalation management. Iran has closed its airspaces as well, but it's not necessarily a go order. And I think, quite frankly, a lot of this is giving the president some room to maneuver. He was boxed in a lot of the decision-making process. And it was a perfect sort of moment to say, you know, his red line was related to the lethal force and the impact on the protesters. And since there was a pause in reporting on that, he was able to step away and maybe, you know, deliberate between, you know, the non-kinetic and kinetic options he has at his disposal.
What is the future of the regime in Iran, do you imagine?
Well, I think that's a very big question. You know, it's unfortunate because there's no silver bullet, right? You know, what happens is very unclear. I think this is the beginning of the end. It's not an overnight process. But what that end is defined as is very hard, because the key thing that needs to happen are defections by the security nodes, whether it's the Basij, the IRGC, and we haven't seen any of those defections yet. I think the concern is, and that's what everyone's worried about, is that potentially any strike on Iran could unify these hardliners, and there would be obviously regional spillover. And so if you see a pivot and you start seeing defections, then I think that's when you can start predicting what could happen next. But right now, we're still in the thick of these protests, and I don't think the people are going to quiet down anytime soon.
What do you make of some of the rhetoric we've heard today? It was just a few days ago that Donald Trump was saying about help is on the way. There was a lot of sort of ramping up of the rhetoric. We've now heard today President Trump talking about the killing stopping, the Iranian foreign minister appearing on Fox News and saying everything's now under control. What are we to make of this change in rhetoric, if you think it is a change?
I don't think it's necessarily a change in rhetoric. I think what he's, I think what he did was essentially testing an off ramp, seeing how he can buy more time. Or, you know, again, we can't predict what his decision making is. Or it could be that there could be more of a surprise if this is going to be a strategic kinetic action. So I don't know if there's a change in rhetoric. I think it's just buying time. I don't think that the current U.S. administration is letting go of the situation. And quite frankly, given the large crowds, the large protests, it's not going to let up. You know, it will be the weekend very soon in Iran, where you're going to see a larger formation of protests coming out. The internet is still blocked You've only had, you know, direct telephone calls that barely held up today after 6 days. So the people are still angry. The people are getting angrier and angrier. So I don't think President Trump has necessarily changed his rhetoric, but he's slowing down whatever action the U.S. would take.
And what tools at the disposal do the White House have at the moment? How could action take its course? I mean, would that be just military strikes? Could we be looking at cyber? Could we be looking at all kinds of other options that the U.S. president would have?
Yeah, he has quite a few at his disposal. So on the non-kinetic side, he's, like you said, there's the connectivity issue. So fund, legally enable VPNs and circumvention tools, secure messaging, cloud backups, satellites like Starlink workarounds, you know, countering signal jamming. On the cyber side, disrupt IRGC, the besiege, the security nodes is command and control, and the switches they use to cut off the phones and the internet, do more targeted human rights sanctions, designations on commanders, judges, and on the diplomacy front, you know, coordinating with allies, you know, whether it's downgrading allies downgrading their position in Tehran or expelling Iranian ambassadors out of certain capitals, doing a messaging campaign with the G7, the EU, the UK, you know, essentially imposing more sanctions, trying to put out the message that it's not business as usual. On the kinetic front, though, obviously, you know, it can be highly targeted on specific facilities that are enabling this repression. And it shows a very clear objective, a very clear response to what President Trump has been saying, or he could do a broad salvo against the IRGC. But the unfortunate part with that is that it inevitably will harden the hardliners and bring a rally around the flag moment.
Thank you for your time. Much appreciated. That's Niga Anger, who is former senior advisor at the US State Department, was also involved with the White House national security under President Biden. Back to the police chief constable, still in his job. Mira says, your previous caller was right, Henry. All day long, you've collectively piled on this police officer as if he's committed a crime. The caller mentioned Gaza and Israel's role, and you said, let's not get into that. Well, because can you not see the difference? These are football fans who happen to come from Israel. They're not coming over here acting on behalf of the Israeli government or the IDF. They were coming here to watch a football game, and the intelligence with which they would be able to attend that football game, we've now learned today from an independent report, it doesn't cut the mustard. It wasn't up to it. So let's not get into that, people making that point to me, because it's completely separate, the war in Gaza, to what we are seeing with regards to people coming to a football match. It's 11:45.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
The chief constable of West Midlands Police, the one caught up in that row over misleading MPs over the use of AI. Be in no doubt, the decision by West Midlands Force to ban the fans from that team, that Maccabi Tel Aviv team, showed how the hardline elements in the Muslim community were able to drown out the concerns of Jewish people in that area. I have to tell you, my friends, anti-Semitism is alive and very well currently in this country, and precious few are doing much about it. And coming back to that copper, I'm not suggesting he's an anti-Semite, by the way. I'm not suggesting that. I'm suggesting he's just not up to it. He deceived Parliament. He's delusional to think that he can stay in his job.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
Hiya, Kenny the Hamster here, beloved pet of Doug and Carol Brookbank. Now, I've got to hand it to Doug and Kazza. They're doing school pickups, jobs, trips to the supermarket, and still find time to get healthy. Apparently, it's down to some NHS Healthy Choices quiz. Only took them 5 minutes to do, then gave them a simple plan to get started.
Come on, kids.
Total amazeballs!
Take your first little step to healthy. Search NHS Healthy Choices quiz to get a score and a plan that's right for you.
Always dreamt of running your own business? It might be easier to achieve than you think. With a franchise, you benefit from a tried and tested business model and ongoing support. Kickstart your journey to business ownership. Visit the British and International Franchise Exhibition on the 30th and 31st of January at Olympia, London. Meet exciting franchise brands, watch inspiring talks, and get free expert advice. Book your free tickets today at franchisetickets.co.uk.
Brands that use radio are 49% more likely to get noticed. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org, assuming you want to get noticed.
A Thames Link train is a place where you can just switch off. Where you have the chance to scroll your feeds as you roll past fields. Or simply relax with a podcast, playlist or power nap. Go with your flow and save with advanced tickets at thameslinkrailway.com. Terms apply.
Another early morning gym session skipped. Some New Year's resolutions set you up to fail. But a new Mazda CX-30 is the one you will want to keep. Available with 0% APR and a £750 deposit contribution during the Mazda January sale. Order by the 31st of January. Search Mazda. Available on PCP when financed by Mazda Financial Services by the 31st of March 26. Indemnities may be required. Terms apply. Participating dealers. See website.
Leading Britain's conversation with Henry Riley. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
11:48 is the time. Keen for your thoughts this evening. The Chief Constable of West Midlands Police still in his role. Should that be the case? By the way, I just want to set out my position really clearly here, because there's clearly some misunderstanding. There are some fans of Maccabi Tel Aviv who are clearly complete idiots and chant some outrageous and offensive thing directed towards Arabs, as they say in their chants. That is completely unacceptable. However, when a police force makes the pretty astonishing decision, bold decision, to ban a group of fans from a football match, you would hope that the evidence with which they used would cut the mustard, and that the evidence would be in black and white, and that we could back it up. The independent chief inspector now has said that on sort of 7-8 points there was exaggeration, and there were things that just didn't happen, like people being thrown in the canal. I'm not saying the fans are saints, but if you apply that bar to football fans, well, I go to football fairly often, and you hear terrible things being chanted. You wouldn't have football matches. By all means, the rogue fans that they have, don't allow them in. But when you stop a whole cohort of fans, you've got to have a bloody good reason for doing it. And it doesn't appear like they did. Earlier on, my colleague Andrew Marr asked the Shadow Home Secretary, Chris Philp, whether the position of the Chief Constable was tenable.
What the West Midlands Police did was appalling. They first of all identified a threat by Islamist extremists in Birmingham who might attack the Maccabi Tel Aviv fans. What they should have done is they should have stood up to that, they should have arrested the perpetrators, and they should have protected the Maccabi Tel Aviv fans. But that is not what the West Midlands Police did. Instead, they tried to make the problem go away by banning the Maccabi fans, and they fabricated an excuse to do that, involving alleged misbehaviour at a previous game in Amsterdam, and we now know that was completely made up because the Amsterdam police and the Amsterdam mayor have confirmed that. So Craig Guildford, the Chief Constable, I'm afraid, does have to go. If he doesn't resign, the Police and Crime Commissioner of the West Midlands, Simon Foster, should fire him.
Well, that still hasn't happened as we move into Thursday. What are your thoughts? Sean's in concerts. Hello, Sean. Is there anybody out there, to quote Nick Abbott? No?
I cannot hear it. My network's gone down, Per.
Okay, well, I can hear you, Sean.
My network's gone down.
Okay, well, can you hear me? Because I can hear you. All right, bye. Thanks. Should I get Sean back? He's having a bit of trouble with his old network there. Do you call me Pet as well? Lawrence is in Wembley. Hello, Lawrence.
Yes, good evening, Henry. Well, the evidence is compelling against the Chief Constable. He obviously hasn't done the honourable thing but to resign. Therefore, he should be relieved of his duties. And the Home Secretary should do that.
It seems astonishing, doesn't it, that the Home Secretary currently doesn't have the power to just sack him.
Well, you know, we've had enough now in this country. We need to, you know, it's a cover-up. They've tried to bring out all these different things to cover up what they've actually done, and they've been found out, and the buck stops at the top, as in any organisation.
What do you make of people saying, though, well, some of these fans have been chanting some pretty nasty things that police were trying to stop? Yes, they may have changed the evidence, but what they were trying to do was, they would say, for the greater good. They were trying to stop it all kicking off.
Well, there was a match, and I can't really cite it now, but where there was a similar situation, but the police actually bussed the away fans into the ground to protect them. And so I don't hold with that argument. I think we can all see what the real reason was. And it's unbelievable when the Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, even before placed objections. I think the police are supposed to police without fear or favour. And in this case, I think that the Midlands Police and the Chief Constable were both fearful, and they favoured one section of the community against another, which is disgraceful, in my view.
Do you think he will go, Lawrence?
He'll go, all right. He won't be here next week. If you want to have a bet with me.
Well, I don't think I'd fancy my odds, to be honest. But you think it's imminent?
It's imminent. I remember many years ago when Geoffrey Howe, was it, stood up in Parliament against Maggie Thatcher, saying, for God's sake, go now, in the name of God.
Yeah, well, it was actually an old Cromwell quote, wasn't it? And then Sir Geoffrey Cox said it to, David Davis, I should say. Sir David Davis said it to Boris Johnson, in the name of God, go man. Thank you, Lawrence. Let's go next to Sean in Consett. Hello, Sean.
How are you doing, mate? I think
you've got your broadband sorted now. We couldn't hear you before.
I know. I don't think he should go, because I think he's saved a lot of hassle with there could have been a bloodbath, mate.
But based on what, Sean?
Based on that there was people outside gonna, you know, it could have really been catastrophic.
Catastrophic.
It could have been, mate. It could have been a bloodbath. And then where would the government have been then?
Sure, but the problem is, Sean, a lot of the things that were cited by the West Midlands Police. But let me just say, I mean, the West Midlands Police, for their reasons for not allowing this to go ahead, is, for instance, they said that there were people being thrown in the canal. There was one person thrown in the canal, and they were a fan of Maccabi Tel Aviv. There was allegations they were linked to the Israeli Defence Forces. One of the key things as well, Sean, was that they needed 5,000 officers in Amsterdam, and that would take away police resources. Well, it turns out that wasn't correct. It was 2,000. So
this wasn't in Amsterdam. This was in this country.
No,
right?
But I'm saying, but they
and
based
they
it on.
Off, mate.
But they based
what happens, what happens if it had a kicked off?
Well, you'd like to think the police would deal with it. I mean, that's what happens at football games. That's why we allow Millwall versus West Ham, and why we Arsenal versus Tottenham and whoever else to play.
I tell you what, it could have been really, really, really dangerous if them fans had been allowed to go into the pitch.
But do you see, Sean, why is that only the case when it's fans from Israel?
It's not fans from Israel. It's any fans that cause any bother.
But again, Sean, you wouldn't have games taking place in this country if there was a handful of fans who were not particularly nice human beings, horrible human beings.
But Henry, at the end of the day, I've got no say. You know what I mean? All I'm giving my view is that it could have been catastrophic.
So you think it was?
It could have been a bloodbath, mate.
So it was a precaution, in your view?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. All right, Sean, thank you. Please, you've got your broadband sorted out. Thank you, Sean, there in Consett. Paul's in Preston. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Henry. All right.
Hey, what do you think about this? Should he stay in his job?
I have no allegiances either way on all of this.
All I'll say about it is, it's just a football match, Henry.
Yes.
People need to get a grip. Well, it's not a world event.
Sure, but it sets a bit of a precedent, doesn't it?
Please let me finish.
Sure.
Because I haven't got a lot to say.
All right.
So it's not a world event. And if it had gone ahead, and somebody got badly injured, you'd be crying even more.
But Paul, you can say that about everything.
Yeah, you can. But you can say this about this, because it's true.
Yeah, but you could say that about protests that take place in London, for example. But and then you're in a situation where you ban protests.
It happens.
It doesn't happen very often.
Well, it does happen, though.
But this was based
on... I think everybody's making a big mountain out of a molehill, Henry.
Okay.
You love you, by the way.
Well, no, it's nice because, look, I have a particular view. It's nice to hear other views as well. I'm not sort of immune to hearing what other people have to say. I just think if you're going to cancel a football game, and I know, as you say, it's just a football match, but with everything that's going on and the free broad atmosphere between mostly, you know, Jewish people, and in particular, seeing people come over from Israel in this case, you've got to have a good reason for doing it. And if there's any holes in that evidence... Then you open yourself out for criticism.
I get that. But the thing is, what you taking by what you've just said there, if somebody had got injured, and that team does have an history of violence,
yeah,
and somebody had got injured, just even one person, right, you'd be crying even more. A lot more. So I just don't get it. It's not a world event. It's nothing.
Okay.
In the grand scheme of things... It's absolutely nothing.
But you think he's sort of fine if he stays in his job? You're not bothered by it, basically?
Listen, Henry, I don't know whether he should or shouldn't stay in his job. I'm not going to say that either way. I said that before. I'm not taking sides on it. All I'm just stating what I've said.
What could happen? All right. Thank you, Paul. Appreciate it. And look, it's nice to hear your side of the story as well. Thank you very much for all of your calls, all of your messages. On that, putting it in a nice way, I mean, look, some of the messages are getting in, there's a way to phrase it, right, if we don't agree. Can we all just try and agree a little bit, or disagree a little bit more agreeably, I think, because we don't need to have sort of heightened tensions, do we? Anyway, you'll be delighted to hear we are going to move on. Coming up...
All road users need to sit within the law, and that's all ridiculous to think that because you want to have the laws apply to road users that somehow you're anti anything at all. You're not. You're actually pro-safety.
That's serious. And Duncan Smith, new traffic lights and pedestrian crossings introduced in the capital to curb excessive speed and dangerous behaviour by cyclists that also threatened with £50 fines. Is it fair or are cyclists just singled out? And later in the show... speak with Sir Phil Redmond, the man behind Brookside, Grange Hill and, yes, Hollyoaks. He's asking you to nominate your town of culture. What's something about your town that we might not know already?
On your radio, on the LBC app and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midnight, the West Midlands Police and Crime Commissioner has refused to sack the head of West Midlands Police as calls for Craig Guildford to go increase. Simon Foster says he's waiting for a parliamentary review into the decision to ban Maccabi Tel Aviv fans from a football match. West Midlands Police have apologised for mistakes after a report accused the force of overstating threats. Russell Langer from the Jewish Leadership Council has been speaking to LBC.
The one question remaining is why? Why do they feel that this is the decision they had to come to? It's also fundamental that we don't allow that to become the end of the story. We will be continuing discussions with government and locally to make sure that these serious issues, be them in Birmingham or elsewhere with policing in this country, are taken seriously.
The US president says he's been told that killings in Iran's crackdown on nationwide protests are stopping. Donald Trump says he believes there's currently no plan for large-scale executions.
They told me that there'll be no executions, and so I hope that's true.
Does this mean military action is now off the table against Iran?
No, we're going to watch and see what the process is, but we were given a very good statement by people that are aware of what's going on.
Iran had threatened to target American sites in neighbouring countries if the US leader intervenes in anti-regime protests. Here, the government says the British embassy in Tehran has been temporarily closed and will now operate remotely. A new rail line will be built between Birmingham and Manchester. Ministers say it won't be a reinstatement of HS2 after the previous Conservative government scrapped that high-speed route in 2023. Phase 1, to open in the 2030s, will see improved connections between Sheffield, Leeds, York and Bradford. Concerns around South East Water have been raised with the regulator as some customers face a seventh day of dry taps. Sir Keir Starmer says daily emergency meetings are happening about supply issues in Kent and Sussex. The company insists it's working around the clock to fix things. And Sting has paid more than £500,000 to his former bandmates in the police since facing legal action over unpaid royalties. The cases hinge on the interpretation of agreements made between when the band formed in the late 70s and 2016. LBC weather. Heavy rain and strong winds moving into southern England and Wales today. Isolated showers for western Scotland, a high of 10 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Daryl Jackson.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Henry Reilly.
And a very good morning to you. You're listening to Henry Reilly here on LBC. We will completely and in full give you an update on whatever happens in Iran, if there is any updates from the US, although we are going to move on. So, as I say, we're keeping an eye on that. Later on this hour, by the way, as I mentioned a few times, we're going to be speaking with Sir Phil Redmond, who is the man behind Brookside, Hollyoaks and Grange Hill. He's also the chair of the government's Town of Culture plan. And I want to know from you, I sort of hinted at it then, because I heard this somewhere else and I thought, well, let's nick that. Not today, it was a few years ago. But what is something about your town that we might not necessarily know? Some sort of quirky fact about where you live. We'll come to that at around 12:30. So you've got plenty of time, but message in a quirky fact. It might be that someone lived there that we didn't know. It might be that there's something there, underground or even above ground, now knocked down, that we don't know about your town. It can be as weird and wonderful as you like. We'll come to that at 12:30. 84850, the number to text, or you can WhatsApp 0345 606 0973. Some of the messages, not going to get to all of them. But yeah, your idea and your knowledge of your local town would be very much appreciated this hour. We're going to start, though, this hour, and this is what I really want your calls on, are these new changes to cyclists in London, but we're going to broaden it out to the whole country. And in Regent's Park now, they have made a few changes. They have started to install new new traffic lights in a way to sort of curb down on cyclists. Now, this has been a big issue in Regent's Park. If you're not from the area, I won't get into too many details, but there's been some sort of sense that it's used as a sort of a way for people to get Strava points, which is a sort of exercise app, and people use that as a bit of a race track. And so that's become a concern for many. But cyclists in Regent's Park will now face new traffic lights aimed at improving pedestrian safety after a series of crashes and near misses. The Royal Parks charity said it's going to install 3 signal-controlled crossings, traffic lights, on the outer circle that is one of the capital's most popular cycling routes. There are various new crossings, but crucially as well, cyclists caught jumping red lights at these new traffic lights could face an on-the-spot fine of £500. The charity Cycling UK welcomed the measure, but said the greatest danger to pedestrians comes from people driving. The work is due to be completed by the spring. I would like to know from you this hour, surely we can agree that there are some idiots road users across the board, car drivers, motorcyclist riders, and cycle riders as well, cyclists, clearly, indisputably. And so you can do one thing, you could concentrate on one problem without basically having to equate them. So clearly there is a huge issue with people who die and who are killed as a result of cars, massively, and the way it is with cyclists doesn't even compare with that. So let's make that absolutely clear. But nonetheless, people are rightly and understandably frustrated when they see people brazenly going through red lights and when they see people doing 25, 30 miles an hour in 20 zones, when cars aren't allowed to do that. So why are cyclists too? So is it all a bit of a mountain out of a molehill when it comes to penalising cyclists? Do you think it's fair and should be more readily enforced, the £50 fines for cyclists going through red lights? Or do you feel that cyclists are just singled out? 0345 6060 973 is the number to call. We'll come to your views on that. First, though, can speak with Donica McCarthy, who's co-founder of the Stop Killing Cyclists campaign. Donica, these new traffic lights, speed limits, it must be welcome news then.
I think there's a particular problem in Regent's Park. It's basically used as a racing training velodrome, and it's not designed for it. And so we've got this natural conflict between its use as a park and for people walking there and children playing, and people training for a high-speed sport. And I think really, okay, the traffic lights are a step in the right direction, but really what we need is a velodrome in North London.
Oh, okay.
A velodrome.
A velodrome. And how would that work?
Well, in South London, if you want to train to be a speed cyclist, you go to Herne Hill Velodrome. Mm. And you cycle around in circles for an hour before you go to work and you train. The problem in North London, there isn't a velodrome. And so people go to Regent's Park because it's got a road that goes around in a circle. I don't think this is an appropriate place to have a road in a circle in a park. But the wider issue on... that's a real key issue here.
But, I mean, people will say, Donica, that we have a velodrome in the other part, as you say, of London. And, I mean, if we're using London as an example, and that people are still cycling like crazy in other areas, even if you leave Regent's Park.
Well, the thing about the Times and the Telegraph and the Mail is they're constantly demonising cyclists as being these mad, demonic cyclists. A cyclist at 20 miles per hour a car driving at 20 miles per hour is 2,300% more lethal than a cyclist. A cyclist would have to go at 95 miles an hour to be at the same lethality as a car 20 miles per hour.
Yeah, but it's not a zero-sum game, is it? I mean, we still have people who get in really badly injured when it comes to being hit by cyclists.
Well, if you think about annually... around one person a year gets killed by a cyclist cycling dangerously.
Mm.
Five people get killed by cows. And every single day since Charlie Allison killed that lady tragically in 2018, five people have been killed every day. So we're talking about 16,000 people have been killed since then. And what are we talking about? We're talking about people speeding on cycling. Well, if you brought in laws regulating cycling speeding, you don't save a single life. What we should be talking about is measures that save lives. And things like that should be compulsory speed limiters for drivers, compulsory breathalyzers for drivers, and compulsory CTV black box for drivers. That would slash the number of people being killed.
One of the examples that's cited is the tragic situation with Hilda Griffiths, who is an 81-year-old pedestrian, pensioner, walking her dog, and was killed by a cyclist who was travelling at 25 miles an hour on a 20-mile-per-hour road. Do we need speed limits to be applied for cyclists?
No, because a cyclist at 25 miles per hour versus 20 miles per hour, you're talking about the kinetic difference, is minuscule. The lethality is minuscule compared to a car.
Say that to the family of Hilda Griffiths.
No, let's talk about science and facts. The same, if you run down the road, Henry, running for a bus, and you bump into an 81-year-old lady who's not looking where she's going, you could bump her over and kill her. That doesn't mean we bring in speed limits for you.
I'm not accusing Hilda Griffiths, though, of being careless with the way she was walking.
Well, no, actually, my heart goes out to her.
Right.
It was a terrible accident. What did happen is the cyclist wasn't prosecuted. Why? Because, like many, many pedestrians who walk out in front of a driver looking at their phone or are not looking, the driver isn't at fault. And in this particular case, the cyclist was not prosecuted because, tragically, the lady walked out without looking. Now, I believe everybody using the roads, whether you're a cyclist or a driver, should always presume somebody's going to make a mistake.
Mm.
But the law doesn't. The law says if a pedestrian walks out in front of you without any warning, you're not charged whether you're a driver or a cyclist. That's tragically what happened in this case.
Sure. What I can't understand, though, is I completely agree with you, and I think there is a campaign in a lot of cases for people who want to persecute cyclists and who think and clearly that is massively exaggerated. What I would say, though, is it is not unreasonable where cars have to abide by a certain speed limit to why don't all road users have to abide by that? That would make it so much simpler.
Yeah, well, so if we're actually asking for equality, yeah?
Yeah.
So equality would be having a speed limit of 95 miles per hour for a cyclist. Because that's the same danger. If you want to treat
people
equally.
But hold on, we're talking about speed here, Donica. I mean, why not just have a level playing field when it comes to...
I'm agreeing with you.
Yes, but why not at the same mile per hour? I mean, you're talking about...
Because I'm talking about equality of danger... Equality of lethality, equality of killing.
But what would
somebody.
Be the argument against having someone going 20 miles an hour on a 20 mile an hour road?
What possible reason
do they need to go faster?
How are you going? Well, the vast majority of cyclists don't cycle at 20 miles
per hour.
Great.
Well, then let's introduce it.
Because are you actually then going to require every single bicycle to have a speed limit, have a speedometer on it? It's just not nonsense because it wouldn't save any lives.
Well, I think there's a way... I don't understand why you wouldn't have it going the same way. Can I move
because,
you...
Do you want to save lives or not?
Yes, of course I do.
So why would you introduce a law that saves no life?
Well, because it's also about principle, though, isn't it? Clearly there is
You can't have both. You either want to cut debt...
Sure.
..or you can have a notional principle that will cost millions of pounds to enforce and won't save any lives, when I'm proposing we bring in laws that does save lives.
Yeah, but this is also about a perception, isn't it, Donica? And if you have a situation where cyclists do not need to abide by the speed limit, other road users will say, well, how on earth does that work?
Because there's no sense in having a speed limit for cyclists. Because even if you have a speed limit of 30 miles per hour, almost nobody gets to it. And if you want to actually talk about people breaking the law, 87% of drivers close pass, 50% of them break 30 miles per hour, 3% of them drink drive, and 34% use mobile phones. All of those.
But we,
kill
I mean, if
people.
You look at the drink driving laws are being changed. The government's road strategy plan. You look at low traffic neighbourhoods in London. You look at speed limits being reduced to 20 miles an hour. I mean, there are changes that are being introduced, Donica, to try and save lives.
Yes, exactly, and that's exactly what I want to do.
Okay.
And what you are proposing is something that won't save any lives.
Well, I'm not proposing it. It's just it's an idea that I would not see the issue with someone being asked to.
How are you going to put in a speedometer on every single bicycle?
That's true. Well, that's true, and that's tricky.
How much would it cost?
Well, I don't know. I don't know the answer.
You're talking about millions upon millions, and that money could have been spent better.
If you are doing a stupid speed, then I think you've got to take some responsibility as well, which I think even you would accept, Donica, that there are too many people who don't accept that.
What I'm saying is that even if people are speeding on a bicycle...
Okay.
The lethality is tiny compared to somebody doing breaking the speed limit on a car. So if you're at 25 miles per hour in a car, you're talking about 2,000 times more dangerous than a cyclist doing it. So
yes.
Let us focus on what let me put a proposal.
Okay.
That's about equality. I have an e-bike. When I reached 60, Henry, I was getting slow.
Right.
And I wasn't able to get around as much. I thought, I either get an e-bike or I'm going to lose some of my social life. So I got an e-bike. That e-bike, by law, has a speed limit on it that doesn't allow me to go over 15 miles per hour. Okay?
Okay.
Now, why shouldn't that be required by law on every single car, that they can't break the speed limit, whether it's 20, 30 or 60 miles per hour? Isn't that not a good law?
Of course, because it wouldn't make people break the speed limit. So, yeah, there's
exactly. That would save lives.
A proposal from... Let's finish on a note of agreement, Donica. We can both agree that cyclists caught jumping red lights, a £50 fine is fair. Surely we can both agree on that.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm happy with £50. It goes up to £300. That's insane.
£300?
Yeah, they're talking about actually making it a worse crime in the City of London, which is silly. I think £50 is fair.
God, and there will be people shouting at the radio, Donica, as you know, saying, well, I see it all the time, cyclists, and sometimes I even slow if I'm crossing the traffic lights just to make a point because cyclists can flagrantly go through red lights.
And we're going. What I think we should do on that, you'll have loads of people screaming at the radio. If we should have what they do in Europe and North America, in many cities in North America, we should have the Idaho law,
which is
that the pedestrian has priority, and if the red light and there's no traffic, a cyclist can go through it. Because actually, if you look at the law, in the last 10 years, I think that's actually in the last 15 years, there's been one person in 15 years has been killed by a cyclist breaking the red light. That is, I think you'd have to be waiting at a junction for 15 million years before you have the odds of somebody being killed by red light, jumping by a cyclist.
Thank you, Donica. Always enjoy speaking with you down the years. Donica McCarthy, co-founder of Stop Killing Cyclists, the campaign group. I want to hear from you now, because I do think there's an element where cyclists are unfairly treated, although I do note, as a relatively inexperienced driver, I've been driving for just over 2 years, I find it dangerous when I do sort of dread it sometimes, where particularly on my road in Putney, it's really busy with cyclists going very quickly. It is used as a bit of a trail sort of a route for them, and so I do find myself often feeling like I'm dodging them and not feeling completely safe, noting that I can obviously do more harm to them than they can to me in my car. And so they, you know, I'm not sort of saying they pose a massive threat. But I do think if you do have a speed limit, it's not unreasonable for all people to obey that speed limit, which I thought, although Donica disagrees with me, and that's fine, that's his view. So keen for your views on that and whether it is reasonable and proportionate to start charging people who run red lights, cyclists, £50. 0345 6060 973, the number to call. Are we waking up to cyclists flagrantly breaching the rules, or are we actually cracking down too hard on people who are exercising and getting out of their cars? 0345 6060 973.
This is LBC.
From January the 16th until the 18th, celebrate the grand finale of the extraordinary sale at Bicester Village. Discover the most exceptional savings in select boutiques. T's and C's apply. See bicestervillage.com. Bicester Village. What will you find?
For the nappies, peekaboos and tea parties. Mess, tantrums and sleepless nights. All those yo-yos, action figures and shinies. Lifts to mates, lifts to parties, lifts everywhere. For each and every one of those teenage years. Let's be honest. You probably owe your parents one. So tell them about pension credit. It could boost their pension income by an average of over £4,000 a year. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
40 million people listen to commercial radio each week. That's 80 million ears. Give or take. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org.
Henry Reilly on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
12:19 the time. Good morning. You're listening to Henry Reilly here on LBC with you until 1, taking your calls at this hour on cyclists. And this idea that, it's coming in Regent's Park, one example. We're talking about it for the whole of the country. Cyclists face new traffic lights aimed at improving pedestrian safety after a series of crashes and near misses. Noting that you're far more likely to be killed by a car. Completely understand that. And Donica's view there. But surely that is reasonable to have people slow down. The roads, the places where people are crossing are not racetracks, right? You wouldn't get away with it if it was a car. You shouldn't get away with it if it's a bike. But what say you? 0345 6060 973 is the number to call. Let's go first to Joshua, who's in Coventry. Hello, Joshua.
Hello, Henry. Are you okay?
I'm well. What do you want to tell me?
I'm a coach driver.
Okay.
And if you've tried to drive one of them around central London, it's an absolute nightmare with cyclists.
Mm. In what way?
They'll come down the side of you and they'll cut you up. And if they damage the vehicle, they've got no insurance. So obviously the company's got to pay out of pocket for it.
Right. And so does it put you off driving in the capital, does it? Or what?
I hate it. I try and get out of it at every single opportunity, because if I knock a cyclist over, it's going to be my fault. Even though the cyclist is in the wrong, because we're classed as professional drivers.
Do you think, though, that for too long we've been, we haven't given cyclists the fair use of the road that they deserve?
some of them take the mick.
In what way?
They will jump the lights, they will take up the whole road when they don't need to, when there's a cycle lane clearly there. Like in Coventry, the council has spent over £500 million on cycle lanes, and they're not being used.
The guest I had on, Donica McCarthy, is a cycling campaigner and has his view very clearly, but he made the point that we should have what they have in Idaho, where if there is no pedestrian that is near, cyclists should be able to run red lights. What do you think about that?
No, they should abide by the rules the same as a motorist.
Yeah.
They need to have tax, they should have insurance for sharing the road with us. Then it's only fair, they should pay their fair share of it.
Well, I'm interested, in your view as a coach driver then, I mean, cyclists aren't going anywhere, coaches aren't going anywhere, you're going to have to learn to share the road, as we are with other people as well. How can we make it work so that both of you are happy?
Well, they've already introduced stuff because of incompetent pedestrians and cyclists, so when you obviously go around the capital, some vehicles now have a requirement. If you have, if put your indicator on, it goes vehicle turning left or vehicle turning right. It's because people have been squashed, because they're not looking where they're going. And they're obviously jumping lights, they're getting in your blind spot, and you're squashing them. So there has been measures made by, obviously, the Department of Transport to try and combat this, but the cyclists aren't helping themselves sometimes.
OK, thank you very much. Appreciate you calling in, Joshua in Coventry. 0345 60 60 973 is the number to call. These new traffic lights, will it really slow down cyclists in your view? Do we even need to worry about cyclists slowing down? The piece that I'm reading in the BBC, also in the Times, says that there have been a series of near misses, been a series of crashes. There have also been very serious, fatal, actually, accidents at that particular area at Regent's Park. Interested to know how you think we can best share the road if we have this tension at the moment. 0345 60 60 973, the number to call. And is it reasonable to charge cyclists £50 if they run a red light, even if there's no one else crossing? John's a first-time caller in Bognor Regis. Hi, John.
Good evening. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
Actually, I am cycling last 5 years. And my experience...
Sorry, just you said cycling the last 5 years, did you say, just to be clear?
Yes.
Okay,
and
go on.
Every day.
Okay.
I'm cycling from Bognor Regis centre town to the Lidl's every single day, sometimes twice. So, I'm not a professional bike rider. I do not have Lycra, and I'm going to shop. So, my experience is that drivers are not aware of highway code. You know what I mean.
Who aren't?
Car drivers.
Car drivers
are not aware of highway code, and right. It's not true that. Cyclists are jumping red lights.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Cyclists are always... we've got to tell the truth. I mean, you may think that they shouldn't be penalised for it in as much of a way, but the idea that cyclists aren't running the red lights, I mean, come on.
Yeah. You know, what I would like to say that heavy code, page called H2, is... 4 years old, but drivers are not aware of this. Car drivers are not aware of this, and bicycle riders like me are actually in danger, to be honest.
By car drivers?
Yes.
And what is it that they do that puts you in danger?
Because they ignore me. They ignore red lights as well. In our town, in front of the Tesco red traffic lights, they ignore traffic lights absolutely every day.
Okay.
And I'm telling you, I'm every day. So, no, I want to say one more thing.
Okay, you go for it, sir.
I am not like a bicycle rider. I am cargo. I'm going for shopping. You know?
Yes, you're casual. You're not wearing the Lycra. Yeah. You're wearing your tracky bottoms.
And so I ride my bike on a pedestrian because of my safety. People on pedestrians are angry with me.
Wait, you ride on the pavement?
Yes, because it's I am safe there.
Well,
if I go on the road,
he's breaking the law.
Excuse me, we are talking about Bognor Regis, not about London.
Well, you shouldn't be cycling on the pavement.
Yes, if I am safe to ride on road, then yes, I would ride on the road.
Nope, it's illegal under the highway codes to cycle on the pavement.
Thank you very much for reminding me.
You are breaching the highway code. We have a rule breacher.
So, can you say this to my council? And to organize in cities bike lanes as they are in London?
Yes, but it doesn't mean you can break the rules, John.
Of course I can, because
no,
it's
you
my
can't. No, people walking don't need to be inconvenienced by you going down with all your Tesco shopping on the pavement. Come on, John.
Safety. What does it mean, safety? What does it mean, safety? For who?
For people walking.
If I am riding a bike in pedestrian speed, am I a danger?
You're not allowed to do it. I mean, you could say if I steal one orange, am I making a big impact? Well, you're still breaking the law.
Good, like it. Okay.
Yeah, are you going to stop doing it, John?
Yes, I'm going to stop doing
it. How long do you have to cycle to get to your supermarket?
How long? It's actually less than half an hour. But this bit I am riding on a pedestrian, it's last 3 minutes.
I think you need to walk. You get some exercise in your legs, man, that's walking. Don't worry about this cycling nonsense. Get walking.
Thank you for reminding me of that.
Yes. All right. Thank you. All right.
I like you.
All right. I'll see you next time I'm in Bognor Regis. Bye. All right. John there. Bognor Regis. Where was that going? Is that a wind-up? Dom Jolly on the line. Rick's in Bournemouth. Hello, Rick.
Hello, Henry.
Hi. What do you think? What do you make of that previous caller?
Oh, well, crazy, isn't it? Absolutely crazy. I'll just tell you one thing before I get to my experience.
Go on.
The stuff that was going on about the fact that cyclists have to go about 95 miles an hour. He was talking about collisions only. I mean, cyclists can cause an accident by going too fast. A car can swerve out the way, for example, and hit another car or a pedestrian.
Yeah.
So it's not just a collision situation, which he overlooked. It's the fact that if a cyclist is going hell for leather, and the it causes
well, that's true. Yeah, it can cause between other road users.
Absolutely. My experience was, Henry, was when I've been worked in London for about 20 years.
Yeah.
And when I was coming down the embankment, a cyclist coming down the slip road from, I can't remember which bridge it was now, but...
won't be Hammersmith, it's been shut for ages, but anyway, go on.
No, it wasn't Hammersmith, no, it was the one near Fleet Street, I can't remember what was it. Anyway, he lost control, he was flying down there. He landed upon my bonnet, would you believe? Dented the bonnet, did all the damage. He had been drinking as well. He was one of these cyclist come messenger type chaps, you know.
What sort of bike was he on?
One of the e-bikes
or not?
No, it was before that time, actually. It was like
I think it was
Blackfriars
Bridge, by the way, not to be... But I think
Blackfriars. It was Blackfriars. I used to work at Daily Mail, you see. Anyway.
Very nice.
But the point being that he gave me this fictitious address. Cost me about £300 to put the bonnet right, and it was dented and scratched and goodness knows what. You see, cyclists don't take a test. They don't have insurance and so forth. You know, they are free agents to do exactly what they want and cause damage and goodness knows what without any repercussions.
But they feel, cyclists, that they are unfairly targeted.
Well, I don't think they are, really, quite honestly. I mean, I've got a cycle. I don't do it now because I think it's too dangerous, to be honest with you.
But they'll say, just on that route, they'll say, well, if there is a red light and the pedestrian has crossed the road, why can't I go through that red light? Why is that? Why do I have to stop my bike? What would you say? I mean, I would argue that you don't know who's coming out, do you, on a crossing? But they'll say, well...
No, you don't know what's happening, do you? I mean, you know, like you said, Henry, I mean, there should be a universal law. You can't start cherry picking, you know, what laws you're going to adhere to. And, you know, if car drivers had the same attitude, well, we'll go to the red light because there's nobody there or whatever, there'll be absolute chaos, wouldn't there?
Thank you very much, Rick. In Bournemouth, appreciated. More calls in a moment. 0345 606 0973 is the number to call next. We'll speak with Sir Phil Redman, the man behind Brookside, Hollyoaks and Grange Hill. He's asking you to nominate your town of culture. Tell me something we might not necessarily know about the town where you live. We'll get to that next. 12:32 is the time. The news is with Daryl Jackson.
There are growing calls for the head of West Midlands Police to be sacked over a decision to ban Israeli football fans from a match in Birmingham. Craig Guildford insists the decision to stop Maccabi Tel Aviv fans from attending a game at Aston Villa wasn't politically motivated, but a report found the risk posed by supporters had been overstated by the force. The US president says he's been told that killings in Iran's crackdown on nationwide protests are stopping. Donald Trump says he believes there's currently no plan for large-scale executions. Denmark says fundamental disagreements remain between the US on Greenland after a meeting with officials in Washington. Donald Trump's threatened to take over the Danish-controlled territory. LBC weather, heavy rain and strong winds moving into southern England and Wales later. A mix of cloud and isolated showers in western Scotland, a high of 10 degrees.
LBC.
Money Super 7, our mission continues. How are we helping people save today?
We could help people save up to £193 on their home insurance.
Good start. What else?
They could also switch their car insurance with us. We've got some great deals. How's that for a day's work?
Impressive, but it's not home time yet, Money Super 7.
See how much you could save with Money Supermarket. 51% could save up to £193. Consumer intelligence, buildings and contents, November 2025, 17 plus UK only.
Find me somebody to love.
Hey, Beds, wake up. The Dreams Mega Clearance event is now on.
Sorry, I'm just so comfy.
I bet you are. There's up to 40% off a range of stylish beds and comfy mattresses. So shop now and save big. Dreams, love your bed.
Brands that use radio are 49% more likely to get noticed. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org. Assuming you want to get noticed.
This is LBC with Henry Riley. Call 0345 60 60973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
12:34 is the time. Good morning, Henry Riley with you here on LBC. We are going to be talking about towns in a second. This is your last chance to have your say before we speak with Sir Phil Redman, the award-winning producer and screenwriter. But what is something about your town we might not necessarily know? Coming to that in a moment. So you can WhatsApp 0345 606 0973 is the number to call. Let's speak first with John in Greenwich. Hello, John.
Hello. I just want to say... Yeah, you can hear me.
Yeah, could you talk right into the phone? You sound like you're sort of... in a bath.
I am. Is that any better?
That's slightly better. Go on.
It will do, yeah. No, I'm a white van driver. All these cyclists, what they need to do is get their bikes and crush them like they do when you've got no insurance and no tax or MOT on your vehicle. Yeah, take them down to the compound and crush them. Forget the £50 fine going through a red light. That's not a deterrent enough.
We should crush their bike?
Yep.
Come on, John, you don't believe that.
No, seriously, yeah. Because you know what? Do you know me, cyclist? I've nearly killed. That crossed the road onto the pavement, go shooting across the middle of the road, you know, with oncoming traffic coming down. No. If they've got no licence, no insurance, no tax, they don't have to pass any test to be on the road. Anyone can pick up a bicycle and just take it out on the road.
Yeah, they've got these Lime bikes now. Other companies are available, but you've got these e-bikes you can get anywhere.
Yeah, so therefore, well, maybe the Lime bike and the e-bikes carry an insurance. I mean, they should carry insurance, shouldn't they?
All I would say to you, John, is yes, there's a legitimate argument to say that they should be going through red lights. We slightly lose the argument, though, when we say that they are they should all be crushed.
Yeah, crush their bicycles, and if they want, put their clothes in and crush that as well, and their helmets.
Can't we just increase the fine?
No, because, you know, they need to... Look, if you drive a car on the road and it's not taxed MOT, then the police pull you over and you've got no insurance, they're going to take your vehicle to the compound and it's going to get crushed.
Yeah, you're obsessed with crushing, John. Thank you. John there in Greenwich. More calls in a moment. First, though, as I mentioned, the first ever UK Town of Culture competition is going to take place to restore pride in communities. It's chaired by Sir Phil Redmond, the award-winning producer and screenwriter. He's behind Broadside, Hollyoaks, Grange Hill, and joins me now. Sir Phil, thank you for your time. What made you take up this role? Didn't have enough on your plate.
Well, because having chaired, I'm still chaired in UK City of Culture, but over the last four iterations, you know, through Derry, Hull, Coventry, and now Bradford doing a great job last year, one of the challenges was always how do we sort of incorporate the places around towns, you know. And there was back in 2017, I think 2018, there were a lot of small cities, towns, others came together and said, look, we know we're never going to win this competition, but there's so much culture and creativity outside the cities and in rural areas, and we just get drowned out by the urban noise. Anyway, when Lisa Nandy came into post into the DCMS, you know, it was music to my ears, really, listening to her talking about, you know, wanting to do more for towns. And so I said to her, rather than try and spin the City of Culture, you know, to try and take in towns, you know, that's a very successful project and it's really working really well. Why don't we just do something about towns? And she said, that's not a good idea and all that kind of thing. She says, who do you think should chair it? And I said, well, I'm not really sure. And she said, well, I think it should be you.
You walked yourself into that one, didn't you?
What I like about this as well is
we know that no town is the same, obviously, but there are huge discrepancies in terms of resources, in terms of size. And I like with this that there's a small, a medium and a large town chosen.
Yeah, exactly, because one of the things you start thinking about, it's bad enough trying to compare cities and cities, but when you start thinking about towns, and as you say, you've got sort of market towns, rural towns, you know, you've got coastal towns, industrial towns. So it's like trying to compare apples and pears. So we decided that probably the easiest thing to do would be go back to the ONS and ask them, well, what's the definitions? And they come up with a thing like anything, a small town is anything less than 20,000 people, medium 20 to 70,000, and anything above that is a large town, you know. So actually, I mean, you find out you've got cities like Bath or Barth, depending on how you want to say. It's actually a city, but it could be considered as a large town too. So, and that was the way we thought we'd do it. So we'd also pick the kind of best unique creative story from each of those categories, and then out of those three we would then I've been talking about this all day, and every time I say it now I think, oh my god, that's going to be like such a challenge then, to choose one town out of all these to be the town of culture. Anyway, we will do it in the end, and that town will get 3 million, and then the other two, if you like, runners up, and we'll get 250,000. Which, you know, those sums of money are quite significant in terms of towns' creativity and cultural activities. And even the towns who get onto our kind of short or long list, depending on how you talk about it, they'll also receive £60,000 to help them put the bid together, because we are very conscious that despite all my kind of pleadings over the years for towns and cities not to spend a lot of money just to tell their story, inevitably, people want to do a great glossy presentation, so the costs come up. So we're trying to recognise the whole thing by helping them put their bids together by giving them some cash, and then also sort of making it kind of short, sharp, and, you know, sort of making them focus on what is their great story, what is the unique thing, what makes people in that town say, my town is great because, you know, our town is fantastic because, you know, and that's what we're looking for, celebration and pride in place.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you a bit more about. So what is the criteria then you're looking at? So a unique story of the town is something you've touched on. That's clearly key. What else are you and the rest of the judges looking for?
Well, in the expressions of interest, you know, which is now open, you know, I mean, we've got to think about saying to people, like, look, there's got to be a short presentation. We don't want them to go into great detail. So the big things are really about those three, you know, three really important things, which is, what is your unique story? You know, what is it about your town? Tell us how, you know, you're thinking of how you're going to deliver that, you know, and how are you engaging in local communities, you know, and then tell us why you want to do it, you know. And I think they're the kind of main three criteria at the beginning that we just want to, I think. And then later on, there will be, you know, there will inevitably be, if they advance past the expression of interest stage to the short, long list thing, well, then that's when the bigger preparation will be required, you know, because, again, you know, we've got to make sure that, you know, in this straitened times, wherever that kind of public funding goes, it's going to be, you know, it's going to make the impact that we want it to. So, but right now, expressions of interest, we really want people to say, you know, what's your story, the unique story of the town? It's culture for everybody. How will that town deliver a cultural program, event, festival or whatever that will feature everybody in our local community? And then, you know, how do they think they're actually going to make that happen? You know, but overriding authentic voice from the people of the place itself.
And who actually puts the bid together? For an I mean, how can people help? They might want to sort of write to their councillors and go, hey, we should be put up for this. How do people sort of put pressure on?
That's normally what happens.
Yeah.
You usually end up with a few people at the beginning saying, like, this is a great idea, you know, let's do this, you know. And then they get onto the council and persuade them. Because, again, you know, because this is public funds and everything, you really want to have the local authorities involved, you know, because they are the accountable bodies, you know. And actually, having sort of run Liverpool in 2008 and being involved in a lot of these things since then, you know, it is the local authorities that they really are the ones that facilitate it. They're the ones who are going to have to think about the road closures and the safety and things like that. So you need them in. But then they're just the kind of like bureaucratic framework, if you like. But then you want all the other, you want the communities in, you know, you want the police, you want health in, you know, things like that. And also you want just to get business community engaged too, because business is very close to the people. It's probably, business is much closer to people than most of us in life and most politicians. They know what's going on, and they also know, and they can look across at what's happened in cities of culture, where masses of increase in visitors and brings in massive economic benefit. And you get your business community in, they will help guide what they think the local people want. And they'll also then support it, because they know the more people they can bring in, the better it is for business. Because culture creates footfall. Footfall is people with the cash in their pocket. And that is the fuel of the regeneration engine. So, you know, that's it encapsulated, I hope.
and when are you going to launch Village of Culture? Is that next?
Oh, come on, man.
We're trying to keep you busy, give you more work.
Yeah, well, I think what we've shown, what's been shown in places like Derry, right at the very, very, very beginning, and Bradford recently, that they managed to go out into the hinterland, you know, and sort of like bring in those people and take cultural activity out of the city centre to those places and bring those places into the city centres. So, again, that's what we mean about what's the unique story, what binds the place together, you know, and that will percolate up, you know.
Thank you very much. That was Sir Phil Redmond, the award-winning producer and screenwriter. He's chair of the government's UK Town of Culture. Let me quickly do a few of these, seeing as you've been so good enough to send it in. Matt from Southend says, we have the longest pier in Europe. Hannah in Wolverhampton. Wolverhampton installed the UK's first automatic traffic lights in Prince's Square in 1927 as a temporary experiment, making it a significant location in traffic control history. I think there's a bit of AI at play there, Hannah, but that's good. I like that. Thank you. Nice to know that. Jackie says, my town hosts various festivals, including the Paint Festival. Jackie in Cheltenham. I did not know there was a paint festival. Wow. This from, where has it gone? There was another one I wanted to get through. I can't find it here. Oh, here we go. My hometown, Pontypridd, is famous for writers Evan James and James James of the Welsh National Anthem, which I'm not going to try and say. Evan James is buried in one of the parks here. The town emblem is the old bridge. The third bridge has stood since 1756 with three holes each side so the river can go through it if it's flooding. Tom Jones came from Treforest? Sorry, I'm going to upset you here, comrade. I don't know how to say that. In Hove, there's a flat where Edward VIII and Wallace Simpson would often stay. Brighton has the Royal Pavilion, Theatre Royal and Palace Pier. Goodness me, you're giving me a right old list there. Dale says we have a shrine on a street named Lady Lane to a statue of the Virgin Mary that was removed when Cromwell dissolved the Catholic Church. And last few, this says, oh, here we go, from Jim in Somerset. My hometown of Reading had Oscar Wilde and Stacey Keach in the prison there. Also, Banksy painted on the wall regarding Wilde. Other items including Amelia Dyer, says Jim, who's now in Somerset. Thank you very much for your messages on that. We'll come back to cycling and get the very latest with Iran next. It is 12:47.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Richard Spur.
Botched cosmetic surgery done overseas costs the NHS $20,000 per patient to correct, but have you considered risking it? And Iran's closed its airspace as tensions in the region mount, but would you support US strikes?
Richard Spur at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
Listeners, we interrupt the airways to share an incredible discovery. The reason why Britain hasn't been so great of late is because the country hasn't been eating enough Weetabix. We must get to work in rebuilding Great Britain, Bix by Bix, by delivering Weetabix to whoever plans the traffic diversions, to delivery drivers who can't seem to find your house, and people who don't stack the dishwasher properly. To Britain, we must say, have you had your Weetabix?
Go on, leave the never-ending laundry pile, quiet flat, and empty fridge at home. Hop on the train and go into the workplace zone with Southeastern. Whether you're heading in for a change of scene, to share ideas, or enjoy a lunchtime chat with your colleagues, with our great range of tickets, we've got the one to suit your commute. Buy yours now on our app or website and pay no booking fees. So, go on, go in.
Southeastern.
The following is from TFL.
I got loads of flowers the other day. And messages from people I didn't even know. My mate spelled my name in tea lights. And my mom hung my favourite footy shirt on the railings, next to the lamppost, where I got killed. By a nice lady. Just someone who thought it was okay to go a few miles an hour over the limit.
Speeding injures or kills over 1,000 people in London every year. Slow down. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
At ulisprosperity.com, you buy the car and we pay you up to £600 per month in rental income. For conditions, visit ulisprosperity.com.
Henry Reilly on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker now. Just say, play LBC.
12:49 is the time. Let's go back to get the very latest with regards to Iran. Pleased to say I can be joined now by Ambassador James F. Jeffrey, who was the Deputy National Security Advisor previously, also served as US Ambassador to Iraq and has been an envoy to President Trump on various issues from Syria and to counter ISIS. And I'm delighted to say Ambassador Jeffrey joins me now. Thank you for your time. You're a man who has worked with President Trump, a man you know well. There seems to have been a slight change in rhetoric in the last few hours with the Iranian, it's not uncommon, but the Iranian foreign minister saying everything's under control, President Trump saying they've now stopped killing people. Do you think he's softening his approach?
Well, first, thanks for having me on.
Thanks.
Wildly shifting rhetoric is a characteristic of Donald Trump's foreign policy. It's very difficult for us Korean diplomats to get our heads around, but often it works and often it doesn't. Now, we got to see how this one is going to turn out. What we do know, because the family confirmed it, that the one person they were going to execute for protesting was saved and was called off. And I think that's what Trump is referring to. I also just heard, just before I came on the show, that we have apparently sent an aircraft carrier battle group with four destroyers from the South China Sea heading towards the Middle East. So this may not be over yet. But clearly, President Trump is taking a different tone. The other thing is, while I've been involved in some of his one-off decisive strikes in the Middle East, like killing Qasem Soleimani, there is no one-off decisive strike you can do against Iran in the midst of this chaos we see there. And that perhaps is deterring him from taking action as well.
What could action look like in your view, Ambassador Jeffrey?
The usual pinprick, because the many presidents I've worked for, they love that. You bomb something that people don't like, an outhouse in a Revolutionary Guard training area or something like that, and you say that you have, you know, done proportional response. There may be some of that, or the most aggressive would be what the Israelis did a year plus ago in Lebanon, and a decapitation strike against all of the top leaders. But they had intelligence far better than ours. And secondly, they followed up with a ground invasion, taking advantage of the temporary, and it's always temporary, loss of leadership. We don't have a ground invasion in the cards. We don't have the troops. We don't have the intention. Trump was elected not to do that. So even if we did, you know, kill a lot of the leaders, there would be new ones tomorrow.
Mm. And with what we have seen with regards to, you said, about the carrier, with President Trump being very clear that he disagrees with the killing of protesters, it can't be ruled out then that we will see that action despite the rhetoric.
I wouldn't rule it out. The other thing is, we've seen this with other presidents, you get lucky. You have successful operation after successful operation. We had a successful operation initially in Afghanistan, taking down the Taliban and chasing away Osama bin Laden. So then we decided to up the ante and go into Iraq. And you and Britain, because you were there with us in both campaigns, know what that was all about. So it may be that he's been so damnably successful in Venezuela, now selling their oil and having, you know, happy conversations with their new leader. He may think that he can pull the same thing off with Iran. Those of us who know Iran don't think so, but we'll give the guy a chance.
Mm. Do you think the regime of Ayatollah Khamenei is going to come to an end, whatever the outcome?
I'm very skeptical of that. I spent a great deal of time in the next door, largely Shia state, Iraq, and I saw the way the Iranians had this almost cult-like hold over much, not all, but much of the Shia population based upon the supreme leader and what they call Viliyat-e-Fakir, their kind of approach to Shia Islam, very activist. And there's a great deal of religious fervor behind this still today in Iran. Those are the people who have the guns. And these guys really believe in what they're doing. It's evil. It has messed up the whole region. And I watched it mess up the whole region. Nonetheless, they think it's the way to approach the world, and they're not going to go down easily.
Mm. I'm really grateful for your time. Thank you for shedding some light on it. Ambassador James F. Jeffrey was the Deputy National Security Advisor in the United States. He was previously the U.S. Ambassador to Iraq and was an envoy for President Trump, so he knows a thing or two about foreign policy, and in particular the President. Very grateful to have Ambassador Jeffrey join us. Back to your calls with which we started. In fact, there's a few things about towns. Let me tell you, Sue in Harlow says, Harlow is the town of fibre optics. My hubby worked there. Hubby, I love that. In the early stages of development, it's also known as Sculpture Town, with some Henry Moores and others too. This from Riz, who doesn't say where his hometown is. It says we host the annual Elvis Festival. Where is that? Where's the annual Elvis Festival? Maria says in Maldon, Essex, we have the annual mud race across the River Blackwater. Nick in Barbados, I'm in Barbados at the moment, and speaking to a couple in Cheshire, they apparently have every July the Pina Colada Festival. How did I not know that? Paul in Poplar, I nominate Enfield in North London. It has the first ATM machine in the country. John says Telford is a mix of ancient villages and 60s new town. Beginning of the Industrial Revolution was forged with Shropshire sweat. And Dale says Ipswich hosts the biggest free music festival in the country as well. Tony's in Barnum. Hello, Tony.
Hey, James, how are you?
Yeah, good, thank you.
Yeah, I live in Barnum now, but I actually come from Barnes, just down the road from you.
Oh, yes, I'm in Putney, yes, so not many
miles
away.
You're in Putney, yeah. And you've got the World Cup later on in this year, the biggest competition in the world.
Yeah.
But and you go, where did it all originate? Well, if, in 1863, before the rules, that's when the actual rules were written, it was like a free-for-all. There were no rules. You could, it was like a mixture between football and rugby.
Mm.
Anyway, there was a London solicitor called Ebenezer Cobb Morley.
Can I just say, it's really bizarre you say that, because I went for a walk the other day, last week, and I've come across this as well. He's buried in a cemetery not a million miles away from where I am. And it's right by Putney Common. It's not a cemetery anymore, actually.
I know
where
you mean.
Yeah.
Near the hospital.
Yeah, he's old was not there anymore. But
the old hospital,
He's buried there.
Yeah. Well, he was a solicitor in 1863, and he got together with some others, about, I think it was 11 others, and formed the FA. And they wrote, they actually wrote the rules for football that we know basically today, obviously a few tweaks here and there.
Yeah.
And the first ever club game was on the 19th of December, 1863, between Barnes and Richmond. And that was the first ever game of football under today's rules.
Well, I never knew that. Thank you, Tony. That is very useful information in Barnum, previously of Barnes. It's true, by the way. Nick in Barbada says Reg Varney was the first person to use the ATM machine in Enfield. And it's the Porthcawl Elvis Festival, I'm told, in Wales, which does bring visitors around the world. Let's finish off with cycling. John is not on his bike. He's on the blower from Hackney. Hello, John.
Hello, Mr. Riley, and thank you.
Thank you.
I would just like to mention about the cyclists.
Yes.
And I totally resonated with that guy before when he's talking about crushing the bicycles.
Yes.
But I'm talking crushing the cyclists themselves.
What?
I've got total respect for the cyclist. He's got the front and the back light on. He's got a fluorescent jacket, especially at night, you know. But listen, come on. Don't come up on the inside of a vehicle on a left turn.
Of course. But, I mean, this sort of language probably isn't going to help cyclists.
Awards.
They're going to be irritated.
That's Darwin Awards, if you're going to do something like that. So we're doing humanity. I don't mean to make light of it, of course.
Yes.
But, I see the cyclists. They're so aggressive to how that. I saw one in front of me today. He's got two dogs. He's cycling down the road on my estate, and he's shouting at his dogs, and I'm hearing him screaming. I'm out the window. He's cycling down the road with his two dogs. They've got flashlights on them, and I'm thinking, they've got no respect. The cyclists have got no respect. Right. And if anything happens to them, they deserve what they get.
Well, let's not finish on that, because we obviously want to make sure everyone's safety is intact. John, in Hackney, thank you for calling. That is it from me. Thank you for all of you. Obviously, we're not advocating that, by the way. I'll come back to more of your views tomorrow, because I'm going to be here from 10. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the brand new LBC app, where you can stay up to date with all of the latest news and opinion. Download it for free from your app store now. At 4 on LBC, it's Early Breakfast with Ian Payne, but right now it's time for Richard Spur.
Good morning. Cosmetic surgery done abroad costs the NHS nearly £20,000 per patient when things go wrong. British medical tourists can spend weeks in hospitals when they get back, and from having procedures like bariatric surgery for obesity, tummy tucks, breast enlargement, baldness treatment, teeth treatment, but would you or have you risked having cosmetic surgery yourself? First, though, the US and UK have evacuated personnel from a military base in Qatar amid concerns that America might soon launch military action against Iran. Although tensions between the two countries appeared to slightly decrease last night, but with the death toll of protesters now reaching well into the thousands, would you support US strikes on that country if they would speed up the toppling of the current regime? 0345 6060 973.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From
on Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock. The US president says he's been told that killings in Iran's crackdown on nationwide protests are stopping. Donald Trump says he believes there's currently no plan for large-scale executions. He threatened to attack Iran if the regime went ahead with executing anti-government protesters. Ambassador John Bolton, former US national security advisor in Trump's first administration, told LBC he isn't sure if there's been a change of tact from the president.
We used to say no decision with Trump is final until it's final. And I think he's prepared for either eventuality. I think that's what the evacuation of U.S. and U.K. diplomatic personnel from various posts around the region indicates. My guess is he'll wake up tomorrow morning and decide what to do.
There are growing calls for the head of West Midlands Police to be sacked over a decision to ban Israeli football fans from a match in Birmingham. Craig Ilford insists the decision to stop Maccabi Tel Aviv fans from attending a game at Aston Villa wasn't politically motivated. But a report found the risk posed by supporters had been overstated by the police force. Shadow Home Secretary Chris Philp has told LBC Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood must force him to go.
The Home Secretary no longer has the power to directly sack the Chief Constable, but under Section 40, she does have the power to make the Police and Crime Commissioner do it for her. And there was unanimity across the House of Commons, both sides, that Craig Guildford must go. Even the Labour leader of Birmingham City Council has said that. So I really think his position is completely untenable.
The social media site X says it's implemented technical measures to prevent the Grok AI account from allowing the editing of images of real people in revealing clothing. The restriction applies to all users, including paid subscribers. It also says the creation and the ability to edit images via the Grok account on the X platform are now only available to paid subscribers. A campaign group says pothole repairs should come with a 5-year guarantee to prevent short